Are we good? Okay, we'll try that again. Good morning. Welcome to the October 9th San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors. Today's meeting is strategic planning, where we will be focusing on a variety of issues in planning and also with our financial projections for fiscal year 13-14. We're beginning that process today. The format will be a little bit different than what we normally do. We'll start out with a public comment session, and I'll speak to that after the flag salute. So please stand and join me in the flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag.
We are planning to agendize the item for October 30th, our meeting October 30th. So if any of you are here just to make that request, we are planning to do that, and it will be included, and you will have an opportunity at that time to speak. So with that, I just want to forewarn you that that is the case. So if you need to be anywhere else this morning, we will agendize that item October 30th. So we'll begin public comment with Julie Rodewald. Julie?
Good morning, Chairman Patterson, Board. Julie Rodewald, County Clerk Recorder. It's now E-minus 28. And just a heads up to our voters, we're mailing out over 87,000 vote-by-mail ballots today. Yesterday was the first day, but since it was a holiday, they're going out today. That comprises 57% of our registered voters will be getting ballots by the end of this week. People still have a chance to register. October 22nd is the last day. We ask everybody, don't delay. Register early rather than wait till midnight on October 22nd. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you, Julie. Remember that date out there, October 22nd. If you're not registered or if you need to make any changes in your registration. Okay, public comment. Alice Welchert, followed by, please come forward, state your name. We'll begin with Alice Welchert, followed by Lindy Owen.
Thank you, Board of Supervisors, for agreeing to put the seismic testing on the agenda. I'll be back, and I'll be, And I would just like to say in advance, please do not allow PG&E to San Bruno the Central Coast. I suspect, and I say it not with any sense of hyperbole, that the impact of this ocean blasting would be so profound, not only here globally as things like this are happening, that this is maybe the most important decision you will ever make in your lives, and I thank you for your willingness to consider it.
Okay. Thank you. Lindy Owen, followed by Gary J. Freiberg.
Good morning, everybody. Lindy Owen from Los Osos, the Prohibition Zone, where we do not have many nitrates, but we do have saltwater intrusion, mostly because the county has ignored the problem for 40 years. I would like to commend Supervisor Gibson on a fine job of spin for political gain. I'll start with number one, the Diablo seismic testing is pretty much thinly veiled as a safety precaution for human protection, yet what it really does is help the oil business do offshore exploration. Then, of course, the Los Osos mega sewer. We know what that's all about. If you've been listening, it's veiled as a safety precaution for human protection. What it really does is force the importation of Nacimiento water so that Los Osos will have a large build-out that was never possible before. Tri-W was also under Mr. Gibson and Pablo Ogren's planning for the sewer. The Tri-W was the middle-of-town site that was originally going to be a sewer, and we stopped it. Now we're being forced on our sewer bill to pay for restoration of that property. Only it's now being turned into a park. And again, Mr. Gibson, we can thank Mr. Gibson for making sure that that got put into the plans. And on a little side note, I think Ms. Pandora Nash, who is our health, our park commissioner, needs to step forward with Mr. Gibson and go ahead and take the responsibility of putting county funds into making the amenities on that park, because it is not really being restored. It's being turned into a park at our cost. Lastly, in Los Osos, the sewer project has started, supposedly. We have a website called Dig Los Osos that you're supposed to go to and get information. We're paying $7 million to HDR, is the company that is doing contract management, construction management, and the public relations. You're supposed to be able to have some information ahead of time as the digging starts, and we're talking about ripping up every street, you know, and up to 30 days, 45 days on each street to do 1,000 feet of digging. No information on the website. No information on the website. $7 million. What are these people doing? There's no sign on the building. There's no place that a person can walk in and go, when does this start? What's happening on my end of the town? Can I look at my lateral layout again? Or no information. What is going on?
That there was a need, Diablo would be repaired or shut down. We'll approach this, that Diablo needs repair work for the biggest earthquake that we can imagine, and sink the $64 million that the ratepayers are paying in doing whatever has to be done. Hire local plumbers, electricians, and contractors, create good head of household jobs, and use the money to stimulate our local economy by improving the infrastructure of Diablo. You'll accomplish two major objectives by doing so. You'll make Diablo safer, and you'll pump millions of dollars to create quality jobs in our local economy without causing financial devastation to the fishing industry. If you are making decisions based on moral obligation, then you have a moral obligation to consider more than only your one definition of what is moral. You also have a moral obligation to protect the economic stability of the San Luis Obispo County fishing industry, and there is moral obligation to not allowing the take of thousands of sea creatures. Ignoring the economic moral obligation of the fishing industry is the second time Supervisor Gibson's moral compass has disregarded the economic impact of his economic decisions on county families, retirees, and individuals. Much has been said about the difficulty of affordability of the Los Osos sewer to its residents. And now, after you humiliate our community by calling the project Dig Los Osos, you're employing L.A. and Orange County companies and their employees to do the work. You've sent quality jobs to ARB Construction from Lake Forest in Orange County, Rassic Construction from Long Beach, Mountain Cascade is from Livermore. All those companies are using their own people. The millions being spent with these companies is not boosting our local economy. The Los Osos sewer is not creating quality head of household jobs. You've given those to families in Southern California. Where is Supervisor Gibson's moral obligation to use local labor? Without the $170 million Los Osos project assuring the full utilization of our local unions, he ignored the economic consequences to our county. We need a different moral direction.
Thank you, Mr. Freiberg. Ms. Shane Verplank, followed by Nancy Corn.
Thank you. I just want to read briefly a letter that was published that I wrote in and was published by the Tribune a couple of weeks ago. The sentiments expressed by Bob Lilly in his Viewpoint article entitled, quote, "Seismic Test Not Worth Damage to the Ocean," are so true. Don't those of us who were here in 2003 remember the 6.5 earthquake off of San Simeon? We know that there are faults near enough to do damage to the Diablo Canyon reactor from that, quote, test. What more do we need to show us that the potential for a much larger earthquake is there? If we allow the killing of sea life and ruin the reemerging fisheries with these pointless tests, we are really not thinking clearly. No matter how powerful PG&E is, they should not be allowed to dictate damaging tests in this county in order to further their profit goals and at the expense of creatures who can't prevent it and don't know it's coming. All of us should be working on clean energy plans, including PG&E. They have the perfect place to develop wind and wave technologies, which wouldn't require dangerous tests and wholesale killing of ocean creatures. Instead of investing so much time and money into propping up Diablo, they could be a leader in clean and safe energy development. Shane Verplank, Los Osos. And I thank you for considering or putting this on the agenda. I do hope that you will reconsider your position in this matter. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Nancy Korn, followed by Eric Greening.
Good morning, supervisors. I am Nancy Korn, and I've lived in this area for 25 years, and many things have reached my heart, but none as deeply as the proposed seismic testing. This morning, I'm going to read a statement from Marty Brown, who also shares my feelings. Marty Brown says, I, along with thousands of other concerned citizens, implore you as our representatives to write to the permitting agencies involved in this seismic testing project of PG&E, telling them that you will not allow this to disrupt, and damage our marine life, fishing industry, sporting, and tourism business here on the Central Coast. As sworn upholders of the public trust, you must convey this message. As far as trust is concerned, the migration of whales, dolphins, and elephant seals is a matter of trust. These mammals feel their ancient pathways are safe.
Greening, followed by David Broadwater.
Good morning. I am Eric Greening, and thank you for agendizing the issue of the seismic testing to clarify your position and change it. This will be timely for the Coastal Commission. If you can't come all the way to saying absolute flat-out no, your own record from August 7th, your letter to the State Lands Commission, provides ample grounds for very clearly saying not this year. Basically, what you asked for is not happening this year and can't happen this year. Something happened in Sacramento where it appears that there was the perception that the county was giving its concurrence to starting this year. That perception has to be erased, and clearly. The supervisor's letter to the State Lands Commission says, for example, State's Lands Commission should only issue a permit if the technical details of the survey design have been subjected to independent third-party review by industry-qualified experts to confirm that the best available technology is applied to this crucial investigation. That has not been done. There is no time for it to be done this year. We may have differences in terms of what is the best available technology. In my opinion, it has to be a technology that does not kill any sea life, period. And we can take the next year to look for that. Another quote from your August 7th letter. Our board believes that this survey should not be permitted until full and fair compensation for expected economic losses to fishing and recreational enterprises, including those based on shore, has been established. It has not been established. The groundwork hasn't even begun. Part of that groundwork would be a study of the current population of the sea so that there is a baseline from which short and long-term differences can be measured. That doesn't exist. That can't exist in time for this to happen this year. There are also, of course, other impacts, and I'm hoping we can have emergency services here on the 30th because one of the impacts is humans. Beaches will have to be closed. Humans can be killed and injured by being in the water during this testing. How do we close the beaches? This isn't Santa Monica where you have a lifeguard tower every few hundred yards. How do we prevent people from slipping into the water over 70 miles of coast? We may need county council here. The county could be liable wherever it controls the access and anybody unwittingly gets into the water. There are countless issues that have not been dealt with. My opinion is not ever Your opinion, you already have the foundation for at least not this year.
Thank you, Mr. Greeney. David Broadwater, followed by Richard Sadowski.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Board. My name is David Broadwater. I'm from Atascadero. I think it was last year I was down here talking to you, the last time I spoke with you, last year in the spring, I think it was, about the seismic testing for Diablo, and urging, along with a number of other folks, urging you to demand or recommend that the relicensing for Diablo be suspended until the end of the seismic testing was conducted and independently reviewed. And you made a wise decision at that time and did just that. And that and the other efforts by other bodies was successful in getting that done. At that time, I believed and still believe that not knowing nearly enough about the potential seismic activity under and near the plant is very important to address, but now we have some information due to an environmental assessment and an EIR about what the effects of this technology of seismic testing could do to the marine life and the fishing industry in our area, and could severely damage the vitality of both. And so I'd like to associate myself, my comments, with those of Mr. Greening, that you have the basis to act on this, to demand that this not be done now. I commend you for agendizing this for October 30th in time for the Coastal Commission to get your input. And I just think that it's the wisdom that you exercised last year when you said that we had to have this body of knowledge in order to go forward, is I ask you to call on that wisdom again.
Also, citizens opposing acoustic seismic testing coast. Remember, I have a little experience in scientific testing. Back years ago, I worked in the aerospace industry and was involved as a test ops engineer in testing at Mach 6 scramjet testing. And one of the basis for any kind of scientific testing is it has to have some common sense. Okay. This acoustic seismic testing has no common sense. We as a as the United States, we as a country, a Christian country, now are known for enhanced interrogation, torture. Now we're going to be doing enhanced testing, scientific testing. This makes absolutely no sense. And one of the things that we need to realize is that I'm a grandfather, and you know, I'm speaking on behalf of my 4.5-year-old grandkid. You know, what do I tell him? We don't have the right, you as a board, you all have positions of authority. You all wear several hats. But you don't have the authority to mitigate away a child's, a future's enjoyment of our oceans. We don't have that right. We have to look beyond. Any policy has to look beyond ourselves, has to look beyond just, you know, what is the immediate next fiscal calendar. So please take a look and look at the sense, just look at your look in your heart about this issue, because it is a heart issue. It's not just a mind issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sadowski. Gwen Taylor, followed by Julie Tacker.
Good morning. My name is Gwen Taylor, and I concur with Mr. Greening, and I hope that you will take a second look, if you so desire, to take on the seismic testing, because this is affecting not just the coast, not just the ocean, but all of the county. Stepping to another subject, There are some in the San Luis Obispo business community that feel excluded and ignored when addressing the homeless center. Now they know how some in the area of the sewer project of Los Osos feel. If good planning and listening to the public had been done by this board, the money spent on the Tonini site would not have been wasted trying to make a round hole fit a square peg. If an economic impact study had been done of the prohibition zone at the first and their ability to pay would have been addressed, the project well might have been changed. The public was told the Midtown site was only being restored to the condition before the previous sewer project. It has been restored beyond its previous condition at the assessment district's expense. When the Jacamazzi property was selected for the plant site, the public asked if the county had entered into a purchase agreement or option. The public was informed the county is handling this purchase. Los Osos has learned the county has had to take legal action to obtain the site for the sewer project, yet everything is being designed for that site. The purchase of the Andre site is land going to be purchased for the change of the Lupin pump site as well as the site of Jacamazzi. Lupin is a project that should never have been even addressed for a site of the pump site. The public still has to plan to pay their property taxes, plus two sewer costs, and the CSD waste treatment and the USDA loans. They total up to just those two loans at $937.50. That does not include your property taxes. Let's be clear on that. Nor any of the sundry projects that are listed on your tax assessment. No small amount for those who are unable to pay.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Julie Tacker, followed by Ben DeFatta.
Good morning. I am Julie Tacker. And I've handed out a table that I compiled. The project here added to the project in Southern California a 1,300 square mile project that goes from Laguna Beach to Encinitas. That offshore seismic testing combined with our offshore seismic testing will triple the impacts that we're talking about here. The approvals here in San Luis Obispo project set precedent that it's okay to go to Southern California and harass, harm, or kill more creatures there. Just some numbers. Taken from the environmental assessment, which I don't believe your board had access to when you took up this item in August. Of course, you had access, but I don't believe that you it was provided in your staff report, and certainly you yielded the complexity and Mr. Gibson took the lead on where this board went with this project. Our project here off our coast is estimated to harm or harass some 97 California gray whales. The Southern California project, 357 California gray whales, for a total of 454 California gray whales that may or may not survive the project. Gentlemen, crow tastes better today than sea otter tomorrow.
Thank you, Ms. Tacker. Ben DeFatta, followed by Amy Wyatt.
Good morning, Chairman Patterson, Board, Public, Sheriff, pretty near 4 years ago, people voted for change. Problem was, the voters never bothered to ask what kind of change did they think they were going to get. I'm sure the voting public did not want $5 gallon gasoline, massive high employment, millions of foreclosures, higher utility bills, more regulations against small businesses, millions of people retirement funds disappeared, 15 million more people on food stamps that now totals 48 million people. Millions more have become homeless, home equity gone, 50% of graduating students can't find jobs in the field they studied for. In the state of California, 250,000 people and businesses are leaving the state each year. The American dream has disappeared, and a second round of inflation is coming in the near future, no matter who the president is. On top of that, here in Los Osos, the property owners in the zone have to pay off a $200 million unaffordable wastewater project for the next 30 years, and you five, knowing that a better and newest up-to-date sewer project with the latest technology could be built for around $100 million, you just ignored us. Even when many complaints from those in the prohibition zone have told you here in person, emails and phone calls that your flawed, antiquated, expensive, unaffordable energy hog with its deep pipes over several earthquake faults on a village that sits on a sand dune, that your stinking gravity collection project is the wrong project for Los Osos, you still continue to stick together like flypaper. You always let the same man decide on what he thinks it should be built, like the unaffordable gravity collection project. One man, the same man that wants to murder millions of marine life, premeditated murder of marine life, and you other four supervisors, again fell for it hook, line, and sinker. Have you used one of the alternatives? It would have been built by now, and we would all be happy today. The water war would be happy, and the nitrates would be down, and Los Osos property owners would have an affordable sewer up and running. You five have chosen to continue down the path of destroying the lives of at least several thousand property owners to lose their homes, and at least 6,000 people to have to move and or become homeless. In other words, the gentrification of several thousand property owners and at least 6,000 homeowners, businesses, and renters makes no sense. I will skip down to the end here, give you back that lousy 3 seconds you gave me last week. With the world in a killing frenzy in our government, state, and counties in deep financial turmoil, how do you know if the USDA and the SRF will be there to fund a complete project?
Thank you, Mr. DeFatta.
And have the rest of the day off.
Amy Wyatt, followed by Rick Beaumont.
Good morning, Board of Supervisors. I'm a resident of San Luis Obispo, and I'm here to encourage you and thank you for taking the time to further consider the issue of acoustic seismic testing.
Took advantage of Transit Tuesday today and rode the bus in. Rick Beaumont, followed by Benjamin Terra.
Good morning. My name is Rick Beaumont. I'm a local solar energy consultant. I'd like to read a statement given to me by Claudia Layton, a concerned citizen, a Los Osos mother. Good morning, Supervisor Patterson. I know that you and Supervisor Gibson say many good things about PG&E in public. You speak optimistically about mitigation and monitoring, and you say that PG&E treats the commercial fishermen well. How much more thoughtful, intelligent, and representative you would be if you changed your positions based on new and overwhelming facts. PG&E's contractor on the low-level seismic testing does not perform the mitigation and monitoring that is required by their permits. They are working as we speak, and there is no pilot ship with no scout to monitor for marine mammals. There is no liaison officer, as required, to liaison between the seismic vessel and the commercial fisherman to assure required communication or to negotiate compensation. PG&E does not compensate the fishermen. I must insist that as of today, you stop defending PG&E and start defending your commercial fishermen. In addition, I do not want to hear any of you making justifications for PG&E, saying that PG&E agreed to pull out of marine protected areas. Fact is, PG&E did not agree to leave, they were kicked out by the conclusions of the Fish and Game Commissioners declaring that, quote, these are marine protected areas, not marine killing areas. I would also like to read a portion of a letter written by a young lady from Cayucas, a surfer and a businesswoman. This was to the Fish and Game Commission. And this is someone that Supervisor Gibson also knows well. She pleads, I never thought you would be pushovers and let big corporations walk all over your department. Please fight back against this. They are messing with nature here, and there will be consequences far beyond what you could ever expect. Please stand up against this and let law-abiding, trash-picking up, fish-measuring, border-reporting, dog-poop picker-uppers and let them know that you are on our side with this. That is end of her quote. The Fish and Game Commission listened to this young surfer and to all the other people and to the evidence, and they said that they could not, in clear conscience, recommend that PG&E be permitted to conduct this seismic testing. Are you listening to your public? Are you listening to the commercial fishermen and to the surfers? Are you listening to the city of Morro Bay, to the teachers, to the scientists? Are you listening to our native people, to the business owners, and to the children? You must summon the courage, based on new and compelling evidence, to withdraw your support for the seismic testing. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Beaumont. Benjamin Terra, followed by Jerome White.
Good morning, supervisors. I want to say that I agree with Mr. Beaumont's comments, and I also very strongly support Mr. Greening's comments. I'm here to speak about the seismic testing, too. We're not trying to beat a dead horse here, but maybe the public kind of feels like we're not totally getting listened to on this issue, and that's why we keep being so persistent about it. I just wanted to bring up that, you know, the body of the supervisors here, under the services provided description on the county website, it says the supervisors represent the people residing in their supervisorial district while also working for the general welfare of the entire community. I know that all the supervisors took an oath to serve the community when you all went into office, and I ask that you have integrity and that you listen to your community, because serving the community means listening. That's a really important part. And listening doesn't just mean listening to the words. It means taking time afterwards and reflecting and thinking about things that people have said and weighing things out. And you have a really big responsibility to the people in this county. And it's, I hope that you guys take it seriously. I imagine that you do. And I thank you for agendizing the seismic testing. That's a very important step that was taken. I wanted to bring up this information that I have. The vessel that's been out there doing this low energy testing with, I believe it's about 130 decibels, that's about the sound intensity of a gunshot. But they've been out there for quite a few weeks already, and the large female lingcod live out in very deep water. Lingcod are the bottom-dwelling fish that probably migrates more than any of the other fish, except for maybe halibut. And large female...
Dr. C. Height.
Good morning, Chairman Patterson, members of the board. My name is Jerome White. I live in Grover Beach, California. I'll be very brief. First, I want to applaud the board for agendizing this very important item for later this month. I really appreciate it, and I know everyone else does here as well. Secondly, I couldn't agree more with all the other previous speakers. Very eloquent, more eloquent than I am, and I look forward to coming back on the 30th. Thank you so much for your time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. White. Dr. C. Height, followed by Susan Warren.
Dr. C. Height, Los Osos World Community Workshop. Open Studios Art Tour is this weekend and next, and Los Osos was featured in the Sunday Tribune due to the number of artists. Los Osos is an artist community. It's a troubled community. And by definition, the people are oppressed. I'm an environmentally challenged artist, number 99 on the tour, And I bring today a symbol of my burden that I bear, which I will be filling with reams of red tape. All these bags are going to be filled with reams of red tape, which I'm going to be including my seismic testing argument that PG&E would render mute by their ever-changing project. So there's something called environmental justice in the EIR for seismic testing, and gentlemen, this is not it. The concept that even the poor of Los Osos, Morro Bay, Grover Beach, Oceano, I'm not sure there's any poor left in Avila, but the poor are entitled to the same accessibility to the environment as anyone else. And I object that the meetings on seismic testing were held inland, not on the coast, and that the claims process will be in Templeton, where there's the poorest transit. That's public transit. And I conscientiously object to paying PG&E to end life as we know it on the coast. I object that our coastal representative gives priority to infrastructure over the inhabitants. The people of Los Osos, Estero Bay, the sea life from which we all benefit as world citizens. It's not ours. It belongs to the world. Now, we have international tourists coming to Open Studios tour, and it's going to be damaged for 2 years in a row by your infrastructure in Los Osos. As you ramp up to dig Los Osos, are you driving away the birds from their sanctuary the way you expect to drive away the sea life from their ocean sanctuary? They won't be able to hear predators. Whales, dolphins may beach themselves, driven from nurseries, feeding grounds. Animals may starve. You will displace the people of Los Osos, the birds of the air, the creatures of the sea, for infrastructure. For who? Not for the poor, the senior disabled demographic. PG&E cannot make me safe. It can only give me the illusion of safety. And this is what it's all about. It is about the illusion of safety. I fully expect now that there's getting some publicity about the seismic testing that people will come forward and say, yeah, I want it. Make me safe. But a nuclear power plant built on a fault is not, no amount of testing is going to make us safe. This is a right to life issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hyatt. Susan Warren, followed by Al Barrow.
Susan Warren, North County Connection, up in Atascadero. Good morning, supervisors. It's good to see all of you. I just came in to remind you that we are sponsoring a speaker, Community Education Night, next Wednesday, October 17th at 7 p.m. at the Atascadero Lake Pavilion. We are bringing in a speaker that I heard at Sierra Vista Hospital this summer in June, and he's a real asset to our county, and it's Dr. Mario San Bartolome, and he's not only a primary care physician, but he's a specialist in addiction medicine. And he's coming to speak on a new look at an old problem and the addiction and substance use disorders. But he's going to discuss how society and individuals deal with substance use disorders and explain what the future is going to hold for treatment. And that's why I'm here. That's my concern. We have our own seismic problem above land right now, and it happens to be that we're going to be overwhelmed with the number of people needing treatment when, first off, the reentry folks in this coming year are going to need to have community services to support them as they come back into the community. And also, January 1, 2014, it's going to be mandated through the Affordable Care Act that behavioral health, which is mental health and substance abuse, are going to be an issue. We've always looked at it as a criminal justice issue, but it is truly a health issue. And we can begin to intervene with people earlier before we're having to fill up our criminal justice system. So I hope you or your staff, family, friends can avail themselves of coming to hear him speak and see where we're going with the future. It's very exciting, but I'm a little nervous.
Thank
you.
Sue, do you want to give the information again on time and location?
Sure. It's going to be Wednesday night, October 17th, next week, at 7 p.m. at the Atascadero Lake Pavilion. And it's free, plenty of room. We welcome everybody. Thank you.
Al Barrow, followed by Richard Margetson.
Good afternoon. My name is Al Barrow, Coalition for Low-Income Housing. I'm standing on the side of the podium so that they can take a shot of this there you go. It says StopOceanBlasting.com. This is the website that has the information that will inform you about the impacts of the blasting and why it should not be done. It has many links. It's being developed further. One of the items on oceanblasting.com is the information from Gene Hardebeck. Gene Hardebeck is the seismologist that was in charge of mapping the offshore floor faults off of the Central Coast. She's a senior seismologist with USGS. That is United States Geological Survey. She, her office in Menlo Park at the headquarters. She's a very highly thought of scientist. She spent many years at Scripps Institute of Oceanography, which is one of the top oceanography institutes in the world. She's very well informed, and her comments are that with all this testing, the $64 million blasting project, it will not definitively change the information that USGS already has on the faults offshore. It will not definitively change the information they have on the faults here off of our shoreline. What a crime scene. What a waste of marine life. What a waste of recreational opportunities. What a waste to businesses. This, you've got to stop it. I mean, you've got to take the bull by the horns. You cannot give the Coastal Commission your authority on this anymore. You need to act against this yourselves. Mr. Gibson may have been hoodwinked by PG&E, I don't know. But he certainly has no qualifications that match Gene Hardebeck's. None. You don't touch her. Read her bio. Her bio is on the website. And I can tell you, it's a tragedy waiting to happen. That's the authority. Those are the people who know what they're talking about. Those are the scientists. And I would also like to say that there's a big tragedy in the housing market. I'm an affordable housing advocate, and I come up here to talk about that. Ireland has just come up with an idea that would keep people from being foreclosed on their homes, and I think we should start looking at things like this, too. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barrow. Richard Margetson, followed by Laura Mordaunt.
Richard Margetson. This is going to be a change of subject. Yesterday, they started digging in Los Osos. We brought many issues to this board that still have been ignored. I'm going to talk about three of them today and the direction I plan and others plan to go in the future. First of all, the rates and charges ordinance. We told you that the county staff had information proving that the commercial flow to the wastewater plant was not what was stated in the ordinance, that the estimated costs were way underestimated. We were going to sue. Personally, I don't believe in suing unless there's an extreme circumstance. Instead, through the help of a number of documents that the county has produced lately and the irrefutable fact that the commercial flow to the wastewater plant is going to be at least four, probably five times greater than was put forth in the ordinance. District. School district admits that the rate in that contract is incorrect. The CSD admits the rate is incorrect. But as of the last CSD meeting in Los Osos, it was stated that what's holding up getting that corrected is the county. So I guess it's time to go to a school board meeting and let the parents and the teachers and the school board know that the county's holding up a savings to the school district because they just won't admit they were wrong.
Thank you, Mr. Morgenson. Laura Mordaunt, and that is my last request to speak on general public comment. Ms. Mordaunt.
Yes. I come here from time to time, and I listen to the speakers, and I am so impressed with their knowledge and what they have studied and what they bring forth. As a citizen here in the county, I look at the seismic testing, and I'm glad it's going to be agendized. And I wonder, where does common sense disappear to? I don't get why. I would say that, you know, I've studied the five board members. We've been through elections, periods. And so you get an opportunity to hear what you have to say. And what I hear you say, this is counterproductive to that. You do not believe in the seismic testing is what I believe, that you do not believe in it. From what you have stated about your philosophies and your attitude toward this county, which is very positive. So I don't get why there isn't a can-do. Let's try to find a way to work this out. And having it on the agenda, I applaud you for that. And I'm hoping that when we are here and the agenda item is discussed, that we will be impressed with your can-do attitude to solve a problem like this that ended up creating its own self, being caught in the Fukushima, the hysteria, some of the other issues, like it's here. And I agree that why don't we put the $100 million, which is not going to be $64 million, why don't we put that into the solution, assume there is some kind of problem, and let's work toward a solution instead of always throwing money away. We just put money in different places. So that would be my recommendation, is that I'm looking forward to hearing the five of you and your comments next time. I think it's at the end of the month. And I will want to be with you on the subject, this particular one, because I think this is a uniting subject in the county. I do not know anybody who would be in favor of it once you learn about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mordaunt. That concludes requests to speak on general public comment, so we'll close that, and we'll move on in the agenda this morning. Did you want to comment?
I might.
Supervisor Gibson, yes,
Mr.
please.
Chairman, we aren't agendized for action on the seismic testing issue, but I think as we move forward, it would be helpful if you and possibly you and I can work with staff on getting this set up so we can have a productive discussion on the 30th. One of the things I'm thinking is we need to provide access to the board's current position, which is actually a fairly substantial sized file in the letter that we wrote to State Lands. Mr. Greening quotes it quite correctly, and that's really the starting point. And that's the stance that we have communicated to the Coastal Commission as they make their decision. I think the other thing that, as we've said before, our action on the 30th will be as a matter of making a recommendation. You know, we've spoken that this board does not have regulatory authority over the actions regarding the operation of Diablo Canyon, and for the most part, not on the actions of this seismic testing. It lies outside our jurisdiction, and notwithstanding Ms. Tacker's continued suggestion that we have somehow failed to exercise the small amount of land use authority we have, there is no way in which we could condition the seismic testing based on the very small bit of land use onshore in the county that's currently proposed in the Coastal Commission proposal. In any case, that's all appealable to the Coastal Commission, and the Coastal Commission will be taking it up in its meeting that will occur in mid-November. So I'm just making suggestions, get colleagues to thinking about this, that I think an appropriate organizing principle for our deliberations on the 30th might be to refine and confirm or modify or otherwise state our current position as explicitly August 7.
Oh, okay.
So in the staff report of August 7, we have the letter that eventually we sent.
Okay, good. So it can be accessed there. Supervisor Meacham?
Yeah, I was just curious to know who we are going to outreach to provide us with any scientific information that may generate questions from the board. I mean, are we going to have anybody that we're bringing here for this discussion?
Well, I think it's appropriate to invite PG&E to make a presentation on the specific proposal. You know, that reaction really really strikes me, Mr. Chairman. I would be hopeful that we could have a complete discussion of all points of view on this. This is a subject that has a lot of complex dimensions to it, and a lot of indeed moral issues. PG&E is the project proponent here. It is their proposal that we are considering at this point, and I think it absolutely appropriate that whether we like what we hear or not, I think that that's...
Well, and I believe their proposal has been modified since
correct.
We initially addressed it, so it may be appropriate to at least see how it's changed since we heard from them the last time.
And to dig into the why of why is this project moving forward in the way that it is.
Right.
Well, I guess my point goes more towards the issue of, and I don't have any problem with PG&E making their presentation. I think it's important that we hear all sides of this. But I want to hear from another source that would give us their point of view relative to some of the concerns that have been raised that PG&E is proposing. So I think to have a fair and a very well-rounded discussion about this, I'd just be curious to know who we could invite from a professional standpoint that could give us that. Well, and I'm not a seismologist, so I don't know.
Please, no.
I'm not a seismologist, but I do have questions, and I hope that we get somebody to have a good discussion about that.
Okay, and Supervisor Meacham, if you could provide those questions to staff, too, so we can ensure that we have answers to those. At the meeting.
And Mr. Chairman, what I can do is also make available the reports of the independent peer review panel, which has been looking into this. I can ask members of that panel whether any might be interested in being in attendance here. But as the chairman indicates, if you did have those questions up front, we might be able to work toward getting those answered.
I think that would be good to have that, because what I don't want to have happen is we walk away from this discussion and we've just heard just the one side of the argument and not heard the answers to the other questions.
Yeah.
So, and I don't have all the questions, and I'm sure other folks may have them, and I want to make sure that this is aired out pretty well.
And Mr. Meacham, I think your common sense on this matter is really important. I think that's the legitimate, you know, approach that this board needs to take. You know, I will say that there were some mischaracterizations and some flat inaccuracies, you know, as to the technical details that we heard in some of the public commentary today. And, you know, this is at its heart, it has a complicated technical component. It has a moral component as well. And so I think your instincts on this are absolutely spot on.
Yeah, and again, there's certainly been a lot of information brought forward to the public since we first addressed this issue. Again, there's been hearings before the State Lands Commission and also the Fish and Game Commission, where a lot of this information has come forward, and those are resources that we can avail ourselves to. And again, Supervisor Meacham, if you'll let us know what you know you're curious about prior to that hearing, we can be sure to track down that information.
I may, Mr. Chair.
So, public comment. Yes,
just a few things,
Buckshot.
If I may. So certainly staff will work with your board in crafting something and pulling together who we can for the hearing in a few weeks. I think in the meantime, since this is such a popular topic, we will update our website ASAP to consolidate all of the information that's related to this issue so that it's in an easy-to-find format.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Buckshot, for that suggestion and for doing that. Okay, we will move on with today's agenda, and I will ask the clerk to introduce the next item, please.
Our next item is consideration of a report regarding the county's financial forecast.
Mr. Buckshot.
Yes, good morning. Dan Buckshot from the Administrative Office. Wanted to start off with the agenda for this morning's presentation. We're going to start off with the forecast, as was just noted, for the upcoming year, and then look at longer-term trends beyond this upcoming year. And then there's a recovery to be quicker than what it is, but the reality is that it is very slow. But an important point to emphasize is that things are improving. We did hit the bottom around 2009, and things are incrementally improving on all fronts, and I'll speak to that, or at least many fronts, maybe not all. So the highlights, very similar to what I covered last year. The economy is improving, our strategies are working, and the gap is shrinking. Taking a look at this past year, what's happened since our last update is that unemployment remains high. It's around the 8% mark nationally, and we're pretty close to that locally with the national level. Stock markets are considerably higher. They're starting to get into the realm of the all-time highs that were reached in around 2007. They're a little off that mark, but they've improved considerably. Economy's growing at about a 1.5 to 2% rate as measured by gross domestic product or GDP. And last year, one of the focal points of the forecast was the political polarization that's occurring both at the federal and state level. At the federal level, last August of 2011, that is, not 12, this was highlighted with the whole debt ceiling crisis and fiasco, if you will, that the parties could not come together and create long-term solutions towards related to the county or the federal debt limit. And as a result, the bond rating for the federal government was downrated from AAA to AA+, which was the first time that has ever occurred. So additional issues. Record national debt remains. The national debt is about $16 trillion, which is about $51,000 per citizen or about $141,000 per taxpayer. Federal budget deficit, this is their budget gap, is about $1.1 trillion. Which is actually $200 billion less than the prior year's budget gap, so it is moving in the correct direction. Now, that being said, you know, I guess all things considered, our $3 million seems rather measly compared to $1.1 trillion, so that's one thing we have going for us. Same issues. Again, this is very similar to last year. Credit remains tight even though interest rates are at all-time lows. Housing market as a result is still weak. A lot of folks are having difficulty accessing loans in order to take advantage of the low rates. Foreclosures do remain high, even though they are coming down. I'll speak to that in more detail in a little bit. And as I already mentioned, unemployment remains high. It's also the European debt crisis that lingers. And, you know, the reality is we're a very interconnected world these days, and what happens in Europe may not stay in Europe, I guess, to put it simply, that it could have a far-reaching effect. So we're obviously keeping an eye on that. On the upside, some signs of improvement. As I mentioned, GDP is improving. This is not at the rate that many folks would like to see or are accustomed to seeing. Since World War II up through about 2007, the average rate of GDP growth was about 3.5%. So this is considerably slower by comparison. I mentioned the housing market, and then corporate profits remain high and in some cases are at all-time records. So there is strength in the, you know, one of the challenges that businesses are facing, given the uncertainty of the economy, they're a little reluctant to invest some of those profits and utilize the assets that they have because they're uncertain about the future of the economy. So a few new few lingering federal issues and then a few new ones. You can see the political polarization again remains a concern. I don't see that getting better here in the near term given the presidential election and the dynamics at play there. The reality is probably not much happens before January when new Congress and the president take office, whether it's the current or a new president at that time. Federal Reserve has remained very active. Quantitative easing 3, or QE3 as it's known, which is intended to keep longer-term interest rates low, was just introduced recently, which is a sign that the Federal Reserve remains concerned and that the recovery is delicate. And then what I'll speak to, which is the new buzzword these days, is the fiscal cliff that could potentially occur come January 1st if no action is taken. And what these are, what the fiscal cliff is comprised of, is the expiration of the tax cuts that were enacted by President Bush's administration, the expiration of extended unemployment benefits, the payroll tax holiday, and then the $1.2 trillion of automatic spending cuts over 10 years. And this last item is a result of the inability of the committee that was formed to deal with the debt crisis back in fall and late summer of 2011. The automatic trigger cuts were put in place in lieu of an actual agreement, and now it's time for those to take place if that to occur. And these have become known as sequestration here, as you can see. And this is what the cuts would look like. They're fairly substantial. About 19-20% cut to defense, and about a 15% cut to domestic programs, and then a 2% cut to Medicare providers. And many would argue that Medicare rates are already lower than they should be, and that they would be cut further. So this is what will take place. You know, my guess is that this will not allow it to be happen. It's just too. There are others that believe it's made enough headway and that the way to further it more is to cut back on expenditures and or cut taxes or in other cases, increase taxes in order to reduce the budget gap and the deficit. It remains to be seen which direction we'll move here in the future. So again, the key takeaway, same as last year, a fair number of repeat slides here because conditions haven't changed that much, is that we are improving, but at a very slow rate. So shifting gears here from the federal government to the state. You know, the state remains in a very difficult position. This past year, they were looking at a $16 billion budget gap on a budget of about $80 billion. Now, they did take significant actions this past year. About half of that was closed via expenditure reductions, about $3 billion kind of short-term, I would call gimmicks, actually. And then the remaining $5 billion is related to the tax initiative, Prop 30, which is on the ballot for this November. That being said, I would expect a multi-billion-dollar gap for the upcoming year, anywhere in the maybe 5 to 7 range, assuming that the tax initiative would pass. If it were not to pass, add an additional $5 billion to that figure. A few things that are important to note is that if the initiative does not pass, there are trigger cuts that are in place that would take effect automatically that are related to primarily K-12 education as well as the CSU and the universities, CSU and UC universities. That being said, there are many folks who believe that the state may not follow through on those dramatic of cuts to education, and that they might search for cuts elsewhere, which obviously it would be a concern to counties at that point. Not sure what that means. We don't have any detail. A very important component of the initiative, as it relates to counties, is that there are constitutional protections related to realignment, or AB 109, that was affected this past year. Currently, the state has provided funding that is relatively proportional to the amount of expense that we've encountered at this point, but there is no guarantee beyond the budget year. It's subject to the budgetary process year in, year out, and the counties have sought further protection since we have taken on considerable responsibility and risk. So that will be important to track this, not only for the tax initiative, but to see the outcome of the constitutional protections as well. So shifting gears to current local conditions, again, the housing market's improving, especially on the lower end. The mid and high end still are relatively slow by historical norms, historical comparisons. However, the sales price did tick up just a bit, the median this past year, which is the first time in several years, and the volume of sales is increasing, which are both good indicators. Consumer spending is improving. The amount of sales tax receipts has improved a little bit, as has our transient occupancy tax, which is a measure of tourism activity in the county. Looking more specifically at some of the trends, some charts that we've reviewed for the last several years, which we'll continue to look at for historical comparison. The red line is the number of permits, and I guess that's mauve. I'm not really sure what color that is the construction value. And you can see the red line, the number is low. We're still down far below where we were in 97, 98, about 15 years ago. The reason for the spike, as you can see on the value, is that is related to the solar plant, the permits related to the solar plants out in the Carrizo Plain. If those were to be taken out of the equation, that the dollar value would be flat in line with the trend for the number of permits. So we're still way down, especially from where the peak we hit in 04, 05. Foreclosure trends, which is something we've been tracking closely, is moving in the right direction, although it's still quite high. You know, I go back to looking at 05, 06, 04, 05 when the number of foreclosures was in the 40s and we peaked up at 1,500 in the 09-10 time frame. So we are seeing a drop, which hopefully is a sign that things are improving. Again, just to clarify this chart, which we've looked at in the past, the top line, the orange line, is the notice of default. That's when the letter is sent by the bank to the homeowner that states you need to pay up, otherwise we're going to foreclose on the home. The bottom line, the lighter colored line, is actually when those foreclosures occur, when folks are unable to meet the demands. Another positive trend, even though we're not where we need to be at this point, is the percent to foreclosure. So if you go back again, look at 05, 06. Those folks that received the notice in the mail that stated you need to pay up or else you may risk losing your home, only 10% of those folks lost their home at that point in time. Most likely they were able to either sell the home or maybe they had lost a job and were able to secure new employment to help them meet their debt obligations. And that jumped up all the way. What we're looking at is essentially a very small revenue increase, essentially flat, about a 1% increase. Non-departmental revenue is up about 1.5%, as you can see here. On the plus side, we are forecasting an increase in secured property tax. The assessed value is forecast to increase by about 1.5%. That's offset a little bit with a forecasted increase in the delinquency rate. It was of note this past year, the delinquency rate on property tax payments was near an all-time low of only about 1.8%. So we bumped that up a little bit in the forecast. We're not certain that would be sustainable going forward. You know, this past year, property taxes increased about 1%. So we are forecasting a slight improvement beyond that. The others are relatively flat, unitary, supplemental, and property transfer tax, which are all related to property values. Sales tax, you can see here, about a 9% increase. Slightly misleading from the standpoint that sales tax swings a lot depending upon the level of activity, primarily related to Diablo Canyon and the type of work they're doing. This increase is related to the work that would be done there. It would drive an increase in sales tax. All our things being equal, we're projecting flat with this past year's actual 11-12 actual, which was up from prior years, which is good news. And then the TOT, which is the hotel tax, essentially, we're forecasting about a 3% increase. And then the last note, which is important to point out there as far as the assumptions for the forecast, we're not assuming any new taxes or tax rate increases at the local level. Looking at departmental revenue, again, relatively flat, about 0.5% increase. State realignment, as I noted, does remain a concern given that the constitutional protection is unknown at this point in time. And then federal health care reform, scheduled to take effect in a little over a year. Year and a few months, is not factored into the forecast. We don't have enough detail at this point in time in order to accurately build that in, but we would obviously adjust for that as more details become available. And then fund balance available, which is the funding that's available at the end of one fiscal year for the next, we're forecasting at about $19 million, which is relatively in line with historical norms. We obviously had a higher fund balance this past year, but that was a bit of an anomaly. On the expenditure side, essentially forecasting flat, some slight increases for pension rate, as you can see there, and then the pension obligation bond, a slight increase to pay that debt. No compensation increases beyond that are factored into the forecast. We do have agreements with most all of our employee associations that build in a 0% increase for the upcoming year in many cases, so we're working off of that as the baseline. Do want to point out that our workers' compensation liability costs have gone down considerably the last few years. We hope that trend continues and that we can keep those rates down at least for the upcoming year, and that is the assumption for the forecast. On the non-salaries component, so everything other than labor costs, we're going with the current CPI of 2%, and then we have assumed a 4% contingency. As your board is aware, our standard policy is a 5% contingency. We reduced that in fiscal year 09-10 to 4%, and we're remaining at that level for now, at least as far as the forecast goes. So all that being said, to come back to what I mentioned at the beginning, is we're looking at a gap of about $3 million, which is a small percent of our operating budget. Back when we were at $30 million, it was about 7-8% of our operating budget at that point in time. So that is good news. And then the range given there due to the factors involved, a simple 1% variance in the factors you can see on this slide equates to a $1.5 to about a $2.5 million swing in the forecast. So relatively quickly, I'll run through the longer-term outlook, which is essentially an update to the 7-year pain plan, looking at where we've been and where we are and where we're headed. So as you can see, we began in 08-09 with an $18 million gap. It swelled to $30 million in 09-10, and we've now shrunk it to $2 million is what we closed in the current year. And then heading into 14-15, we expect the gap to be relatively minimal. You know, I did update this slide. It had noted the new normal as of 14-15. I decided that term's become too saturated given that there is a sitcom on network TV now called New Normal. I decided it's time to move on from that and go with slow and steady at this point is our new mantra. So that's what we're looking at going forward. Again, a slide we've seen in the past. The concept behind this is to winnow down the use of short-term options to close the budget gap, which we have done. For the upcoming year, we would anticipate, if we stick with our plans, to use to close the gap 90% of the gap through ongoing reductions and about 10% via the use of shorter-term options. Something I wanted to hit on, which is really telling, and this is not a precise chart, it's just intended to convey where we're at new in the forecast. It's a continuation of theme that we've seen over the last several years. We are seeing improvement. It's slow and incremental. By no means are we out of the woods at this point. There are still those that are worried about a potential of a double-dip recession, particularly if any of the components of the fiscal cliff were to take effect. And then inflation is not catching much attention currently in the short term, but given the amount of debt and the ease of money and low interest rates at this point in time, it still does remain a concern in the out years and something that the Federal Reserve is keeping an eye on. So next steps. In November, we will be bringing the budget goals and policies, balancing strategies, and board priorities to your board for review and consideration. We'll be kicking off the budget process with departments in early December. The instructions go out and an update and instructions to departments at that point in time. And then you can see the heavy lifting begins by departments through December, February timeframe, and then that burden shifts to the administrative office for the February to April timeframe. And then similar to prior years, we'll introduce the budget to your board and the public in mid-May, and budget hearings would be held in mid-June. And with that, I would entertain any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Buckshy. I do see some lights here, so there are questions. I just want to lead off with a thank you for that very comprehensive report and the Buckshy projections. I like that. We should probably syndicate that, you know. But I particularly like the graphics. I think that really helps people understand what's happened in the last 12 to 15 years and how things are trending now. I think they're very informative and easy to read, so I certainly appreciate the inclusion of those in your report. Supervisor Hill, do you have a question for
yes.
staff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dan, for this forecast, we're seeing an overall 1% change in assumptions, 1% increase in that sort of slow and steady. What do you think we'll get to at the, I guess, the, well, we're not calling it new normal. So eventually when we're at, and I know a lot of this is still subject to, as you pointed out, state and federal issues, but should the state and federal issues miraculously reach some sort of resolution in the next couple of years, are we looking at a percentage increase at what, about 3%, 1%? What do you project?
Yeah, I would see it in the 1% to 3% range for up to the next 5 years.
Right.
I don't dare to venture beyond 5 years. I get nervous even going out that far, to be honest. But the reality is I don't see it, things increasing much beyond 3%.
And historically we saw increases typically on average, say, 10 years prior to the recession kicking in at about what, would you say, the average?
Well, depending on the year. In the 10 years prior during the boom time, we were in the 7 to 12% range, depending. You know, if we go back prior to that, I think a more historical norm is in the 3 to 5% range.
Right. Okay. So that's hopefully should things get better on the other levels that may affect us, 3% is probably a healthy increase on everything from revenues and such going forward.
Yeah, if we could see increases of 3% sooner than later, I would be quite pleased, because I think that'd be better than what's likely to occur for the next year or two.
Okay. Thank you, Dan.
Okay. I don't see any more questions at this point from the board, so I will open it to the public. I do have one request to speak. So far, it looks like another one may be coming up. Mike Brown.
Mike Brown, representing CoLab. We agree that the graphics are quite helpful. Again, we'd request that they be posted as an attachment with the electronic agenda, so they could be studied prior to the meeting and perhaps distributed.
If I may, Mr. Brown, they were part of the staff report.
They were?
Yes.
They were? Oh, good. I didn't see them. We think it's good that you have an integrated presentation of strategic issues, including the land use issues that follow. One of the questions, I think, is you've reduced staff by something over 200 as part of the PAIN plan. What has been the programmatic impact of that? What's happening in the performance measures to that that could be included to grow these revenues naturally? What about oil and gas development? What about destination resort development? You can feel some demand out there. What about high-end residential areas characterized by very nice freestanding housing subdivisions, estates, ranchettes, rural thematic boutique hotels that would bolster some of the ag industry, and so forth? So we think you need to actually integrate these and not just accept the slow and steady new normal as a fact that you don't have any control over. So it'll be interesting to see on these other items.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Eric Greeney, and that is my last request to speak on this item. Mr. Greening.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and I agree. It was a very well-done report, and the graphics certainly make it quite visible. The one missing dimension, particularly when we're looking at out into the longer term, is the ecological picture, of which the entire economy is a subset. We have no economy without the productive capacity of the earth and its people. And so one place where we need to be humble is in the face of global ecological overshoot, not knowing how that will impact us economically. We know that this year, whether it's a symptom of human-induced climate change, natural variability, or some combination thereof, for example, the vast majority of this country has been a drought belt. The impacts on the price of food tend to be most felt by the people for whom the cost of food is a substantial part of their budgets, namely the poor. And some of it is still being deferred by various gimmicks, but will be felt in the near future. And, of course, government policies can intensify this. For example, 40% of the nation's corn crop now is going into gas tanks by mandate based on chasing this ethanol mandate that seems to get more and more traction as we become less and less certain that it has any climate change benefit whatsoever. It appears that the energy returned on energy invested may be worse than that for fossil fuels. But in any event, there is an ecological setting to the county's and the nation's and the world's economy. And we need to be humble and realize that simply jiggering higher growth in the money supply through quantitative easing and other gimmicks is not going to make us richer, because we can't grow more planet. The only way we can become more prosperous is to become more wise in how we use the productive capacity of the planet, and essentially not mining it, but sustaining it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening, for those comments. You're absolutely right. And when we grow too fast, our consumption oftentimes exceeds our abilities to sustain it, and we find ourselves with issues as a result of that. And I think it might be safe, and Mr. Buckshy, if I get this wrong, please correct me, but Mr. Brown made reference to programmatic impacts due to our staffing reduction. And actually, we've reduced staff over the past several years by about 245 positions, which equates to a 9% reduction overall. And the impacts programmatically vary from department to department, and I think they're best reflected in our budget document, where we do have our performance measures. And I can recall specifically reading about impacts due to personnel cuts in our budget document, and that's probably the best place to find that information. And one comment I'll make is perhaps we modify that slow and steady, and I'm glad you're off the new normal. But I do think realistically we do have a new normal to cope with as we move forward, at least for years ahead. I don't think we'll see the kind of growth that we saw back in the early 2000s.
But, you know, ultimately, whether it's in some cases a year or two or three when some of the RDAs are dissolved completely to maybe 20 years out for those that have longer-term obligations, some of that funding that was going, those revenue streams that were going to pay those obligations would then be freed up to flow as regular taxes would, property tax would, to the schools and to the county, so we would benefit from that eventually.
But I guess what I'm looking for as well is, does this have an impact on the work that the county will have to do at that point in time once these have all gone away?
Well, there's a lot of discussion in Sacramento about what to do about redevelopment as a whole, that, you know, different mechanisms are being kicked around about how to replace the current version of redevelopment with something else that might be more effective and efficient, but they've not made their way through the legislature at this point.
It seems like they're changing the rules of this about every time you turn around and change your socks. The other question I have is in regard to What impact does the from the administrative or paperwork have when we incorporate a new, say, like a obligation bond or a sales tax or these sorts of things? What effect does that have on admin and our financial department doing what they have to do?
Largely it'd be the auditor's office and our office, and then that would be involved in that. And issuing debt is fairly time-consuming. We do use some consultants, but we try to do as much internal as possible. And it, the auditor's office may be able to speak to it in more detail, but they're heavily involved in, and we are as well.
Thank you. Great report.
Mr. Erb, did you want to speak to that?
Good morning. Jim Erb, Assistant Auditor Controller. It does take a lot of time to issue debt, and I think the cost is probably close to $250,000. We try to factor in what our savings will be, what we're going to gain, and make sure that it's worth issuing. But it is significant.
Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. I see no further questions or comments from the board. Again, thank you, Mr. Buckshy, for that report. And this is a receive and file item, so no actions necessary. And with that, and I appreciate staff coming in for the next item on our agenda, but we're going to take a break and reconvene about 11:05. Thank you, Mr. Hill. Welcome back. We'll continue with our meeting after a couple of brief announcements. One is that it's Supervisor Meacham's birthday, so happy birthday.
That's old news.
That's old news.
Really, really old.
Really old. With emphasis on old, I guess. Huh? And then also I just wanted to mention that while they are familiar faces, we have some folks on the dais this afternoon. Well, this morning still, sitting in their new roles as County Council, Rita Neal, and as our County Administrative Officer, Dan Buckshy. So welcome. This is their first meeting in their official capacities as County Council and County Administrative Officer. So welcome. And with that, we'll move along to the third item on our agenda this morning. And Madam Clerk, would you introduce that, please?
The third item on your agenda is a presentation on the San Luis Obispo County Community Design Model.
Okay, and Mr. Stevenson, are you going to
thank you, Chairman
tell
Patterson.
Us a little bit about what we're about to see here?
Yes, just a few introductory comments, and then I'll turn it over to Jeff Legato. As your board recalls, the County Planning and Building Department received a grant from the Strategic Growth Council to undertake a number of studies that will help us implement our general plan programs. One of those we wanted to present to you today, and it's a computer-based program that will help staff, public, and decision makers understand the range of possible effects from different development types or land use scenarios. It's a pretty powerful program. We're calling it the Community Design Model, and Jeff Legato is the project manager coordinating that with our consultant who we've hired to help us with the program. So I'd like to, at this point, just turn the presentation over to Jeff, and he'll introduce Amy Anderson from Placeways. Thanks.
Mr. Legato.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. My name is Jeff Legato. I'm a mapping graphics specialist with the Planning and Building Department, and I'm here to present the Community Design Model. Basically, the model is an analysis tool, like Chuck mentioned, that will measure indicators and provide measurements that would result from land use scenarios. I'd like to take another moment to thank the providers of the data. This model uses a lot of data. It's very data intensive. The assessor and their staff provide a very good database, which we're utilizing in the model. And also CAL FIRE and their staff have been working over the past few years developing address point layer for the rural areas of the county, which we will use in the model. Now, some of the benefits of the model, in addition to what I mentioned earlier, like facilities location, the model will provide us with an accurate account of current baseline development, It also allows our staff to identify primary effects of proposed development and policies. It'll provide us an ability for scenario planning. And probably most importantly, it provides a common analysis methodology so we can have repeatable, consistent results in our land use analyses. The model will also help us quantify greenhouse gas emissions and will assist in the implementation of the EnergyWise plan. I also want to mention that we're coordinating with SLOCOG. I see Mr. DeVincenzi is here today. We're coordinating with SLOCOG. They have a very similar model, but their model is more focused on transportation. Our model is more focused on land use, I believe. So hopefully the models will coordinate with each other very well. And with that, I'll introduce Amy.
Great. So I have a PowerPoint presentation that, there we go, queued up. I really appreciate the opportunity to come and share with you the work that we've been doing. This is a really exciting project that we were happy to be involved in, and I think hopefully you'll see that this is going to be a really useful tool moving forward. So as Jeff mentioned, I'm Amy Anderson. I'm with Placeways. I'm the Director of Planning Services there, and I was the lead on this project, assisted with support in our office. I have about 10 years of background in engineering and planning. About five of those have been with Placeways. And really, my passion is helping communities make better, more informed decisions through technology and visualization tools. And then these are some of the faces that I work with at Placeways. We are the home of CommunityBiz, which is the tool that we're using to do this model. We're headquartered in Boulder, Colorado. But we work with customers throughout the world, really, to use our tools. We were established in 2005, spun off from the Orton Family Foundation. So we were actually built from a nonprofit. We are currently privately held, and we are growing and award-winning in our work. So CommunityBiz is a software tool. It's an extension to ArcGIS Desktop, and ArcGIS is kind of the primary mapping analysis tool used these days in planning. And so we utilize that technology, build on it. And as I said, we were built out of a nonprofit foundation mentality. So our mission is promoting informed collaborative decision making. CommunityBiz is a flexible tool with a lot in it. So what we've built for you in the community design model is just one way to utilize the kind of suite of tools that are provided with the software. So now that you have the software, you're not necessarily restricted to just using it for what we've built for you. There's actually many other ways the software can be utilized, other applications that you could consider. And also it allows you to work with other communities in this area, so you can think about plans that go beyond just the boundaries of the unincorporated. A lot of tools out there have a sort of expert feel to them. We are experts, trust us. We've got answers for you. And that's really not the philosophy behind CommunityBiz as a tool. We feel that everybody involved in the planning process brings knowledge and expertise, and we want to utilize that. We want to bring it together in a common place so we can really start to think and visualize about our future. And so how do you do that? Because a lot of that knowledge comes from a variety of different sources and models and ideas, and so it is challenging to bring that all together in a common place. So what CommunityBiz aims to do is to take all of that information, whether it's an Excel spreadsheet, whether it's a transportation model, and incorporate it into a common visual platform where we can really look at all of this great information that we have and understand our future. The community design model that we've built builds on mapping data and applications already in use in the community. So we asked for a lot of data, and we got a lot of great resources to bring into play. It's a platform for connecting numerous other efforts. So there's some other things that we've talked about already, and we'll expand on that. But we're able to bring in a variety of other efforts in this area. It's adjustable. So the inputs that we are using right now and built on in the future. We also look at growth horizons. So we're bringing in projection data, forecasted data for what's possible. We're also looking back at what's been permitted, what's been evolving, and thinking about where growth is going to go. We also have some mechanisms in there to look at policies. So as you look at options for your plans and your ordinances, we have some mechanisms in there where you can test out different options for what's in there. And we also think about community data, and what I mean by that is there's a lot of assumptions behind this. You know, what is the water use rate that we're going to say is the future? Is it something that's going to be different by each community that you're working with? And so all of those are adjustable within this model. There's nothing in there that's rigid in that aspect. And so with all of that, we can develop scenarios. So making adjustments to all these levers that we provided, we can come up with future options, look at them, test them, and bring that back and refine and adjust appropriately. We've built, and we're working on building, a few growth scenarios that are going to help us think about futures for this area. The CDM is parcel specific, so it allows us to go into a very fine grain and make changes to land use and development. And it uses growth projections for the unincorporated county that were developed through another consulting effort. The way that it works is essentially like this. So this is just a parcel map that we're looking at here. And what you maybe didn't see, and it's kind of tiny on the screen, was here's a map that's telling me how much development is possible for this particular area. And if we go in and we change the land use now, we have a different future possibility. There's different capability by changing the land use of that feature. So that's one aspect of the model. There's also development allocation. So we have the opportunity to then go in and say, if this is what's the maximum potential for this, we can contribute some new houses to this feature, and that will become part of where we've allocated development for the future. Some pretty basic ways to build some scenarios, but very powerful, very localized, so you can really get in there and test out ideas. You can also adjust. What we're looking at here is an example of an assumption where we want to adjust a multiplier that the model relies on. And so when we go in and we make that adjustment and apply that, we're going to get some different responses to what is the overall impact of that. And so there's several mechanisms in there like this where you can actually go in and adjust those inputs. Scenario planning is a process that our tool allows you to do. You can develop multiple different what-if possibilities for the future to really examine a range of options. So it's not just, you know, these are our goals and here's the one and only path to get there. It's testing out which of these different choices and options takes us in the direction that seems to be the best for the path we want to take. You can compare and analyze trade-offs. Every future possibility has pros and cons, and so you can really look at what in a given scenario is going to be useful to you. And it hopefully helps you determine a direction that really is the way you want to go. The scenarios that we've been looking at for the county here are a base case, which is pretty common to any scenario planning process. You usually look at what if we just continue with the current development trends. So development happens in the same way that it's been happening in the past, and we used permit data, we used census data, we looked at a lot of the trends in growth and really tried to project that into the future. And then we had two additional options that we looked at as part of this grant, which were a strategic growth option, which really was exploring kind of more efficient development than just sort of letting development happen. So thinking about, are there some strategic locations where capacity exists or where we might want to expand capacity to provide growth in a different way? And then we also had a scenario that looked at greenhouse gas reductions. So this is tying together with some of the other efforts that we're working on, we'll talk about in a second here, such as a model that we're building for the COG here. So looking at implementing strategies to meet state and local goals, this is something that's a topic in California and a topic locally that we wanted to explore. How you look at the results, you can report on them in a variety of ways, and this is just one example of one way to think about future scenarios. This isn't related to the scenarios that we've worked on for you guys, but this just shows you sort of how you do this, what the impact of that is. Provides consistent results, as Jeff said, in terms of you're repeating the process in the same way. It's relatively easy to replicate this analysis, so we've been building it on one area of the county, and we can easily transport that to other parts of the county and think countywide. And it's a transparent process, so everything in the model, you can open it up, you can learn where the assumptions are coming from, you can share that information with people that are interested in seeing that. So the CDM was built relating to other efforts as well. As I explained, we are working with the San Luis Obispo COG to develop a regional land use model that will have slightly different focus. It will be looking more at transportation as is appropriate for that agency, but will be built on the same common tools. So some of the ways that I showed you the model works are going to be very similar to how the COG is going to be using that data. So with that said, you'll be able to plug in the information from the CDM into this model in relatively easy ways and put that up against some of the growth modeling that they're doing looking at the cities as well as the unincorporated county, thinking about benefits, how these data pieces provide a clearer, broader picture. There's also opportunities here in some of the ongoing efforts with the complete community survey, the infill development standards. The CDM actually allows you to think about suitability, development suitability, where you might place facilities. So there's some really easy ways to do that kind of analysis, as well as incorporating some of the suggestions out of the infill development standards and testing those out in the CDM. So with that, that's as much as I wanted to present today, so I'd like to open it up to any questions.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Anderson, I don't see any other than one I have at this point, and maybe there will be more, and I don't know if you're, well, actually, I'll ask a more generic question. In the overview of your company and the issues that you work on, environmental resources, economy, community planning. The economic analysis, what's the capability of this model to actually assess, let's say, for example, we have infrastructure deficiencies in a community, and I'll get specific in our San Miguel community plan, for example. That plan will include facilities, financial plan, how to fund facilities that we might need for growth. Does your model take that into account? I did notice economy was one of the areas that you analyzed. Does the model do that, or how is that incorporated into the effort?
Yeah, I think in the packet that was provided, I think there was a list of some of the indicators that we're testing out right now, and this is not the end of the list, so there are things that can be added in the future as you go along. And as I think I said early on in the slides, if you have an analysis that's looking at, for instance, facility costs for a specific area, you can plug that information in and you can incorporate that against what you're looking at for land use and growth in that area. So you can bring that data in. We can also, we can look at other economic indicators that would be interesting for this area. But I think there's a handful currently in there that don't quite touch on infrastructure currently. And I think some of the things that we looked at for infrastructure costs were a little challenging because there were some data limitations that we found specifically with that area. So in the future, as better data is available or developed, we can definitely incorporate that.
The plan does have the ability then to incorporate other variables?
Absolutely, yep, yeah. And that's one of the things that we're going to be working on as I'm here is teaching and helping staff to build that in-house capability to adjust and add additional issues as they come up.
Okay, great.
Mr. Chairman?
Supervisor Gibson. Oh, was there?
There was a voice from the ceiling.
I heard that. I just didn't know where it came from. Mr. Wolkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike Wolkin, planning staff. I just wanted to point out that in your staff report on page 4 of 5, actually starting on page 3, there is a list of indicators that Amy was referring to. And under economy, there's several that we have right now, including ratio of jobs and housing, the type of jobs, and also the cost of transit. So those are things that the model will do right now. Mm-hmm. So we could test different scenarios and come up with the effects on those things.
Okay. What I was mostly interested in, though, too, is if you find that you have infrastructure deficiencies or resource deficiencies in a given community, how that might be financed, and if that's something...
Imagine that they would be using that function, and can I get this on an app on my iPhone?
I don't know about the last point, but we intend to start using this model with the San Miguel Community Plan update that's in process right now, and we can use it to test out the effects of different land use scenarios, and we could also possibly use it in doing the alternatives analysis for the EIR. And then we could also use this in connection with a project that we're working on with Cal Poly students. There's a class that's doing design studies for Templeton.
And I guess one of the questions is sort of how the results are presented. I mean, some of this is pretty quantitative, technical stuff that the output might be an Excel spreadsheet. But I'm wondering how much of a public demonstration tool might this be, and how, you know, whether this particular bit of software or is it other software that would be a graphical representation of those things like vehicle miles traveled or commute times or whichever might be able to be presented in a way that the wide cross-section of the community could understand.
Yeah, Amy showed a slide that had one way to present the results in terms of the effects on different scenarios on different indicators, but I'll let Amy and Jeff add anything to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is sort of early days in the tool, so at least for now, anyway, as staff gets their head around it and learns how to use the tool, it's going to be a resource that they can use in the office. But I think what we often do with the software is community meetings so we actually just bring the software in. One of the things that we've been doing lately is actually projecting the analysis on the table and giving people interactive pens to go in and draw ideas. So all of that is absolutely possible, and we're working toward developing technology for the web as well. There are some lightweight ways that you can share scenarios and test ideas on the web right now, but there's lots of possibilities for that.
I would just add to that we did envision using this tool in a public process, in a very public process, showing alternatives and what the effects of one choice over another might prove. And there'll be multiple issues to look at, and I think that's a very important conversation to have with the community. So we saw that one of the major reasons why we wanted this software.
Supervisor Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Couple of two or three points here that I continue to hear, and we have two of these plans here in my district, San Miguel and Templeton. And one in particular is to make sure that the public involvement is heard, and that when this final planning comes back and so the different scenarios that might be presented, that they see actually that input was listened to and it was put in place. The second one, and I know that I've talked to Mr. Stevenson about this, is the process by which all of these different studies are taking. We've got Cal Poly working on one. We have this. And I don't think that the communities understand exactly when certain things happen. And their concern is that this goes all the way to the end. The county does whatever we're going to do, and they didn't have a chance to review this. So I just wanted to convey that I think it's absolutely essential that as this progresses, that the community has an opportunity to weigh in. And Mr. Stevens and I talked about a flow chart of some sort that could be put on a website that could show folks how these different studies are interacting with one another and when they'll take place.
And then the final concern that I hear far too often is the financial aspect of it. And I know that that's going to be incorporated in this. One of the biggest concerns folks have is that, are they going to be paying for all the new development that's going to take place, or is there going to be development fees that will accomplish the added cost to the development? So I just want to let you know these are the things that I'm hearing from my folks out there, and I want to make sure that we're incorporating this into this whole discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Supervisor Meacham. Supervisor Teixeira.
Thank you, Chairman Patterson. A couple questions. One of them, along with what Supervisor Meacham said about getting the public involved, I think we had a very spirited conversation with that last week in South County with the Oceano and the Pomo communities, and I think it took some of us by surprise in the results and the questions that were asked and the comments that were made. So I just want to keep those in mind and keep working with the community. Positive or negative comments that we're getting back, we need to work through all of these and keep them going. I don't see anything in here about Caltrans involvement. And the involvement of going from community to community. We're working on the communities, but how are these people going to get out and get to the next community? And I think that's a key portion of this that we need to work on. And the last one is, it talks about water use and it talks about wastewater, but it doesn't...
And if you don't have modal shift in transportation, what you then have is a traffic congestion neighborhood. So it's very important that transportation be looked at with this. And certainly, relative to Mr. Meacham's point on the public involvement and the timing, a sensitive issue with Cal Poly, I remember serving on the committee that was looking at the El Pomar Estrella Area Plan update, and one of the professors wanted her students to have a polished presentation before they approached the community. And that was exactly the wrong way to go. The first thing they should have done was come to the community empty-handed and listened rather than feel that they were on stage to give a polished presentation, because the attitude that goes with, I've worked very hard on this, look how many questions I already have answered, is not what a community wants to hear when they have other questions and other preferences in the first place. So I hope that the Cal Poly people can recognize that we're not here to help students learn to give a polished presentation, but rather to learn that if they're going to become planners, the very first thing is to hear from the community and get an idea of what ingredients they're eventually going to polish. Now, we've been talking about community plans, but there's this huge amorphous thing coming, which is the rural area plan. And unfortunately, unlike the old planning areas or the communities, we don't have groups that are designated that will be sat down with. And I'm just wondering, how are we going to handle the vast Swiss cheese between the holes in these much larger areas in which this vaster area of Swiss cheese is being sliced and diced? How are we going to call people together over these vast areas to participate in the kind of process that has happened on the community level and will happen when we eventually get around to doing other community plans? Because most of the other community plans are in abeyance until the vast areas have been dealt with, and we have to deal with this kind of backwards process of identifying areas of expansion outside the lines, which we shouldn't even be looking at until we know what's going to be done inside the lines. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greeney. That was my only request to speak from the public, so I'll close it to public comment and bring it back to the board, Supervisor Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just got back this last week from a couple days' conference at LAFCO. And I would encourage you to contact LAFCO with some of the this process that you're following here. I think they have a lot of vital information that might be provided to you to help you look at some of the statewide issues that are out there. They went around the room and asked every county what their biggest concern or their biggest issue was. Number one was water. I'd say 98 to 99% of them was water. The second was the conversion of ag land and the loss of what we're seeing in ag land. The county of Stanislaus, I believe they have 9 cities in their county, reduced their sphere of influence by 18%. It's pretty dramatic. But I think that it's important to integrate some of these other agencies that are going to have such a powerful role in making determinations of which it's not supposed to be. LAFCO is not supposed to be land use in essence. I mean, they don't do land planning, but there's a significant influence there in terms of how this is going to go in the future. So this might benefit you by talking to the folks, David Church over at LAFCO.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? I see none from the board. Thank you, planning staff, for the presentation. And with that, this is a receive and file item, so no actions required. We'll move on to agenda item number 4, and I'll ask the clerk to introduce that, please.
Agenda item number 4 is the General Plan Annual Progress Report for fiscal year 2011-2012.
And Mr. Stevenson, you again on this?
Thank you, Chairman Patterson, Chuck Stevenson, planning staff. Just to introduce Karen Nall, who will be making the presentation with her today, is Morgan Terrell from our Housing and Economic section. So turn it over to Karen. Thanks.
Good morning. Karen Nall with the Planning Division. Here we are here today to do a real brief review of our annual report. Again, this is the annual report on the general plan. It's a requirement of the state that we report out how we're doing on implementing the County of San Luis Obispo's general plan. And again, it's from fiscal year 11-12. Some of our accomplishments is we did complete 3 of the board's top 10 priorities. This morning I won't go through those board priorities because that's your next agenda item, so we'll just gloss over that. We did complete 2, that was an increase, so this one thing we've actually increased was increased from 19 the previous year. And with that, Morgan Terrell is here if you'd like any more detail on affordable housing or economics. With that, that was all of our comments.
Okay. You're here for backup, Morgan? Okay. There are lots of tables included in the staff report that give the comparisons between last year and this year. And I would suggest that people take a look at those if they want the details. Supervisor Meacham, did you have a question or comment for staff?
I do. Just one quick question, Karen. On page 5 of 16, when it lists the general plan elements and it shows the element and then the required or optional and the date of the last adoption, it appears as though there's a number of these that are quite old. And I don't know if there are potential dates that these are going to be revisited or do they need to be. I wasn't quite sure what this meant.
That's essentially it. And a good item for your next board priority, if there's something on that list you really want us to do, I think it's part of that board priority. But Chuck could answer that question as well.
Thank you. Chuck Stevenson, I think, some of the items are fairly old. There is not a requirement that we automatically update these at any certain interval. So some are older, but our intent is to update those periodically. If there are some internal inconsistencies, we usually come in and amend those inconsistencies, but we're working our way toward updating all the elements.
Thank you.
And I think it's important to point out, I mean, that caught my eye as well, Supervisor Meacham, but the dates indicated are the dates of the adoption or the last major revision, and I know that many of the area plans, at least the ones that I'm involved with, they get periodic minor updates, so it's not like they've never been really looked at or modified, but also as you go through the rural plan, the idea was to, as I understand it, get that updated, and it would include a lot of the information that would be relevant to these various area plans.
That is correct. However, your board did segment the did segment the land use element update to do a reorganization first. And that's what we're working on right now. We'll have that completed by the end of this year.
Okay.
We'll have a draft out.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. Margetson, did you want to speak to this item or the next item? This item? Okay. Supervisor Gibson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in our next item, we will talk about priorities.
I look at the dates on some of these. I know that the rural plan will take care of a lot of the area plans, but you know there are a couple like the safety plan last checked 1999. You know, as time permits, we might get some study sessions on some of these. You know, I think the safety plan, as we talk about earthquake hazard and tsunami hazard and a lot of those sorts of things, and I've had conversations with some geohazard experts who think it is time for us to go back and look at that. But I think it gets, you know, given our resource constraints, it gets slotted in the right sequence, but I think something that's worth thinking about.
Okay, thank you. Just a follow-up. Captures that, Supervisor Mitchell.
Follow-up with Supervisor Gibson's point. I think it's a good point. What I would suggest is just something for thought. Oftentimes we have half-day sessions where we don't have much going on in the afternoon. If we could take an afternoon to address some of these other concerns that allow for folks that have an opportunity to weigh in on these things, a little more than a three-minute opportunity to interact with a workshop, I think that would probably be beneficial to us. I know we had a number of half-day sessions this year. For me, I signed on to be here all day on Tuesday, so I'd assume get something done.
Eric, if you're going to put a tie on, you know, you might as well.
That's right.
Well, and I have a question for staff. I know just recently, well, within the last couple of years, we had a major safety, and it may not have been the safety element of the general plan, but I remember us going through a very comprehensive safety document, an update with Ron Alsop, and is that different than what we have listed here, which indicates we haven't fully addressed it since 1999?
Right. It is a separate effort that Ron Alsop is working on and have grant funding for that.
And that might, now that I think about it, that might have been an evacuation plan or something rather than the safety. It focused on,
right,
on that. Do you recall
hazard mitigation planning?
Yeah, Ron and Emergency Services, I believe, gave an update on the overall approach to
The department received 137 retrofit forms. 65 dwelling units needed to be retrofitted, representing a savings of approximately 6 acre-feet per year. Nothing really glaring there unless you pull out a $10 four-function calculator. 6 acre-feet, roughly 326,000 gallons times 6, divided by 65, divided by 365, number of days in a year, equates to roughly 82 gallons per day. There's no chance that this ordinance has saved 82 gallons per day per dwelling unit. Total indoor-outdoor consumption in Los Osos is less than 82 gallons per capita. I mean per capita. 82 gallons divided by the difference between a 3.5-gallon toilet and a 1.2-gallon toilet being replaced, that 2.22-gallon savings, would mean that the toilets in these homes are being flushed 37 times a day. The retrofit program for the Los Osos Wastewater Project, the expectations are that roughly the savings would be hopefully around 10 gallons, not 82. Again, false information, staff not evaluating the numbers appropriately, and when this was brought before you, this update was brought before you last September, it was half a page, and there was no backup documentation, no footnotes of where to find out how they came up with the numbers at that point, and now it's in another report. There's no way it's 82 gallons per dwelling unit, and that 6 should probably be a 1.
Thank you, Mr. Margetson. Dr. C.I., did you want to speak to this item? You weren't clear. Okay. You're next.
Dr. C. Hite, Los Osos. And I want to thank several of the board members for bringing up some really important points in all of the hard work done by staff. And a few things have, you know, caught my ear. We're talking about infrastructure for these communities, and there was talks of mentions about transportation. There was also mention about the tsunami, and Eric Greening has spoken numerous times about sheltering in place. And I want you to consider that all your communities are not created equally. Los Osos is public transit dependent, which is probably a good idea, because if you think about the lay of the land, there's only two ways in and out of Los Osos. One's the Back Bay and the other is LOVR. And I personally was stranded in Morro Bay when there was a car accident on the Back Bay. That's very common. And there was also a small brush fire from it. So we have a limited ability to travel in and out. And then there's this idea that we're going to shelter in place if there's a nuclear power plant disaster. But I have spoke about this since 2003, and I would really like to hear someone mention the point. Is there any kind of plan for this public transit that you have in place to move people out of a town like Los Osos in case of any kind of emergency at the nuclear power plant? There's only two ways out. People are not going to be able to get their cars out. They're not going to go down LOVR towards the power plant. They're going to try to go out the Back Bay, which is just already a bottleneck at times. So, you know, let us know for, you know, what your demographic is in Los Osos. It's senior disabled. It's low income. It's showing up on reports, showing up on the EIR. It shows up on the transportation report. You know who we are. We are retired people. We have limited ability to get out. You can't really take a boat out of the Back Bay if it's low tide because it's muddy. And so, you know, we do have limited mobility. So I'd really like to hear, when you're talking about, you know, infrastructure and things being in place and what we can expect, I'd like to hear somebody address the idea of, is there any kind of a plan for the bus to not just take off when they get the word over the radio, but is there any plan for the people to start the buses to pick people up, and where will they be taking us? Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hyatt. And the person who can answer that question is sitting in the audience, Mr. Alcester.
And that the state wouldn't reimburse us if they ever went back to the days of reimbursing us 100% for eligible losses after a disaster. A bit complicated, but what it means is if we had, say, a $6 million loss, then we'd probably be out about $400,000 or $500,000 if the state funded 100% of their disaster recovery funds, which right now they're funding 0%. So that is an issue that we're currently working on. In fact, when I was watching you on the monitor, it prompted me to start an email to Chuck Stevenson to give us the progress on that. We do have a vendor to do that. We have grant funds at 75% offset the costs, which will be about $24,000. And then we have general fund budgeted monies in this year's fiscal year budget for us to do it. So that answers that particular aspect. As far as the public comment question regarding evacuation times. We do have a significant document. We have an existing one from 10 years ago from the last census. It's updated every 10 years after the census. So for about the past year or so, we've been working on one with a contractor that's called Evacuation Times Estimate or Assessment. I believe the federally required term is Evacuation Times Assessment. And it goes into specific details about not only population, the demographics of the population, road capacity, but it also goes into such things as, in particular, talking about Los Osos, what happens if there's a 7.2 earthquake in a Osprey and it's really been raining and the ground's saturated, what roads could potentially fail. As part of that overall emergency planning process, we do have what we call carless collection points, and we do pool the buses together, whether they be school buses, RTA buses, whatever type of resource we can get. In the past, to use a day-to-day example,
One time, the CAL FIRE crews, with their crew buses, their drivers ran out of hours. Of course, CMC wanted their prisoner firefighters back. So we were called and realized that school bus drivers have the same license as the fire captains that drive the crew buses, so we got school bus drivers to drive those. Same thing here. You know, we pool our resources. In the County Emergency Operations Center, the transportation folks actually sit together, so there is a plan in place.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. Alsop. I appreciate you coming down and giving us that information.
Right. My pleasure. Yeah.
Okay. Staff, any follow-ups, or are we good to move on? Okay, that's it. Again, a receive and file item. No action necessary from the board, and we'll move on to item number 5. And Madam Clerk, if you would address that issue, please.
Item number 5 is the report on the Department of Planning and Buildings priorities.
Okay, and Ms. Griffin, are you going to lead the charge, or Mr. Giffen?
Certainly, I'll lead it off, Chairman Patterson, members of the board. So we have a PowerPoint presentation that we're going to bring up. You're very familiar with this type of presentation. We give it a couple times a year. We started doing it in October 2008, and this is the last time we did it was in February, and now we're here for the fall update. If we go to the next slide, our priorities are set by the guiding priorities, which are on the screen before you, that paying customers are not adversely affected, mandates are accomplished. We, in fact, added and modified the third priority, as you can read it on the screen. The department should focus on those items that forward a county comprehensive energy strategy, and that was the outgrowth of a discussion that we had earlier with your board related to a combined presentation led by the admin office along with general services in our department, and what we needed to focus on was building on that effort. And so at the department level, we've now made that change in relation to the priority. And the fourth priority, which has been on there for a while, is to continue to forward the goals of a county economic strategy. So as we go through the next tables, Cammie Griffin is going to walk you through some of the accomplishments. I might say it's a little bit faster than slow and steady. We're making some progress recently, and we'll continue to make progress between now and when we come back to your board with the next priority report update in February. You'll notice some items that we've completed recently, as well as a number of items that will be completed or anticipated to be completed between now and February. When we're at the conclusion of the presentation, I'm happy to give you some comments related to the status of general plan elements that we are thinking about and that have got added to the list that weren't there previously, and talking about priority of those status in relation to some other recent mandates that we will have to be implementing based on action by the legislature. So with that, I'll turn it over to Cammie.
Good afternoon.
Thank you.
Board members, Cammie Griffin, County Planning and Building. Just to remind you, our priority list is made up of a series of tables. The first table are those things that are revenue generating or offset. The second table are the mandated programs, and the third table are those that are currently budgeted, and we call those on our plate that we're working on. The tables have a couple of also designations. The highlighted items are the 2012, early 2013. Got a plan development ordinance that we're working on. A final draft is under preparation. We've been working with an ad hoc committee on that. As has been mentioned earlier today, the reorganization of the land use and circulation elements is being completed. We should have a draft of that done before the end of the year. The Los Osos Habitat Conservation Plan is well on its way with a draft to be completed by the end of the year. We're still working through special events with the uniquely slow business cluster. That was your last direction to us. Suspect we probably won't have that back before the board until maybe spring of next year. We're also working on an infill ordinance. That's being done with a consultant using grant funding. We've got some recommendations for some new things as the items are nearing completion, are completed. Those include the San Miguel Community Plan update, the Oceano Revitalization Plan, And then a new mandate that you might recently have heard of that was issued by our Regional Water Quality Control Board, and that's the post-construction stormwater amendments. Those are required to be complete by September of next year. And then two more, the Camp Roberts Joint Land Use Study, which is being done under a grant and should be completed by summer of next year. And also the e-permits that we're working on for specific photovoltaic systems. This would allow folks to acquire permits for these without coming into the office. There's a couple of things I wanted to bring to the board's attention. There was a whole bunch of legislation that was approved that went to the governor's desk. Some of it signed, some of it not signed. There was one specific mandate that we're going to have to address that becomes effective in January of next year, and that's the cottage food operation, or AB 1616. This basically allows folks to prepare certain kinds of food products in their kitchens and sell out of their homes. So we will need to make some changes to our ordinance to address that. It mostly affects your environmental health department, but there are some land use provisions that need to be made too. We're still evaluating all of the sign legislation. We haven't made it through all of it. So there may be other mandates that were that will require action and will have to go on our plate, our active plate. We also had a request. This is similar to what we came to you in 2011 on olive oil. We had an individual come to us to ask about establishing urban small winery. These would be certain parts of the winery operation that you would do in conjunction with a tasting room within a central business district within the commercial retail category. Currently, wineries are not allowed in commercial retail. This would amend the food and beverage product definition to include parts of the winery production. Obviously, not things like crush and high truck traffic, high impact. But it would be probably the fermentation, blending, that kind of those kinds of processes in conjunction with the tasting room in a downtown. This was not a part of the original set of agricultural tourism amendments. So there's a few things your board could do. You could have us add this to our agricultural tourism amendments, which we're supposed to start working on as soon as the event amendments are complete. You could actually add it to the department's priority list as a separate amendment, and we would just get to it as time permitted, or you could actually add it, as you did with olive oil, to the department's active priority list and tell us to begin work immediately, which would probably mean we would be slower on other items on our active priority list. And our request here today is to ask you to provide direction regarding any changes to the priorities as the department has recommended.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Griffin. I just want to ask a couple of quick questions to follow up on your last statement regarding the olive oil processing. What would that take in terms of making the necessary land use ordinance changes? I mean, how involved a process is it to do that?
Well, for the olive oil or for the small
winery? No, for the small winery. I'm sorry.
It's well, it's a standard amendment. It has its own process. It we'd have to develop the ordinance. We have had
The other thing, speaking of olive oil, we actually have a couple of fall-winter general plan hearings scheduled. In the near future, one in October and then another one in November. Is the olive oil piece connected to those? I know the Planning Commission has already heard it, haven't they?
Yes, and you'll be getting their recommendation in late October.
Okay. I have some other questions that I'll follow up with, but first, Supervisor Meacham, you just
asked the questions that I were going to ask.
Oh, well, that was easy. Supervisor Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the small urban winery issue, I see the individual who brought this forward. We're going to hear from him. And whereas Ms. Griffin indicates a timeline, I don't know that that planning staff's going to be consumed for a year doing this. It's a pretty straightforward amendment, and one that I think is worthy of our consideration as it does relate to our commercial retail core, and is comparable to some other things that are already on our books, but doesn't happen to fit in a particular slot right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, my thought was she gave us three scenarios by which we could pursue that, and I wanted to eliminate the one.
Yeah, good idea.
Which was the ag tourism, because I know that's going to take a while. Supervisor Meacham?
Well, nothing takes long unless if you say it fast.
Oh, you're right. Supervisor Teixeira.
Thank you, Chairman Patterson. Cam, we got a question about the e-permitting process for the photovoltaic systems. It says that it's for specific systems. Is this by manufacturer design? How is that going to...
You know, our chief building official is in the audience, and she could probably speak to that better than I.
Thank you.
Since I also stumble over even saying photovoltaic also.
The Sunshine Electric stuff.
Yeah, I'm anxious to get the answer to that question, and since she's here, I have a couple of others for her.
Sure. Cheryl Journey, building official, and I just shorten it up and say PV systems. it's not manufacturer-specific. It's size-specific modules, size of modules, and the actual output of the PV system itself. So it's broken down in those sizes because the relatively simpler, smaller ones are the ones we're tagging to be the e-permits, as opposed to the larger, complicated ones with the backup batteries and the generating systems.
Okay. And the point of my question goes to, having just moved and been looking at storage buildings, mm-hmm. there's a number of manufacturers out there that build these metal buildings, and they come onto your property and with a permit in 3 days, the building's up and done. And I'm thinking in that process would speed up their operation because it's all – everything's manufactured, done, and it's like a cookie-cutter operation.
Correct, and I just have to allocate some more staff time.
Okay.
My two folks that are working on that are actually out at the large solar plants doing inspections. But that's the theory, is to make the roof-mounted, the ground-mounted ones that are simple, probably two stages, two types of e-permits to track with that to allow for those ones that are the modules are relatively simple. They're plug-ins. They backfeed the meters. We call it spin the meter backwards, but the meters don't really spin anymore. But don't have the battery components and the generating portion on site. That's what takes actual plan review for system components, and the technology is changing daily on those. So those actually require plan review.
Well, and then the part of my question goes, will this go on to other aspects of permits, like I said, with the buildings where you can buy the building and it comes engineered plans and everything, and they can email you all the plans. You look at the plans, boom, it's going on the site, it fits into the zoning, and you issue the permit.
That's our intent in theory, is to have more and more projects available for on-site for e-permits, especially when they're handled by a contractor. We're limited by permits that are built by a contractor, not an owner-builder, by the health and safety codes for verification. So, but that's our intent, to expand our e-permitting capability for folks, definitely.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Ms. Journey, while you're up, I know several months ago there was an issue before the regional board, the on-site septic system, and I see now you have a new charge, and that's the stormwater post-construction. So that's coming up, and you're mandated to have that done in the next year. But what's the status of the on-site septic system? Has that been resolved? Are we back to where we can issue the permits for those, or how's that working?
Currently, the draft that the local board has not been ratified by the state, and I don't know that they even have a date to take that version to the state. Mm-hmm. Part of what put that in sort of a holding pattern is that the regulations for AB 885 from 5 years ago have resurfaced again, and there's been talk of that being ratified by the state. So I'm sure the local board is looking to make sure that they're
anything in place that protects solar access that I'm aware of, and I understand the state's been grappling with it, but I'm just curious – because we've been asked several times to, if we're going to be advocates for renewable energy, wind or solar, that we ensure that they're able to work long term by preventing shading from the neighbor's building or whatever. Where does that fit in all of this, and what do we need to do to move down that path to guarantee solar access?
It's actually an item on the list that are out there. It's part of the policy of the conservation and open space element. So it is on our it's on our bigger list. Mm-hmm. It just hasn't been moved to our active plate yet.
Okay. And I'd like to follow up with what it would require to get that work done if we were to pursue that. That's all I have, Ms. Journey. Thank you. I don't see any other requests at this point, but we do have several people from the public who would like to speak to this item, so I will open it to public comment and begin with Mike Brown, followed by Merle Cliff.
Mike Brown representing CoLab. I was wondering if anyone knew, for example, how much a particular project cost over its life. So something like the revisions to the land use and circulation element takes 2 or 3 or 4 years. But it's a project with a beginning and an end. It has hours of staff and consultants and an EIR, whatever it has to do it. How much does that project cost? Is it $500,000 or $1 million or what? Similarly, how much does the infill development project cost for beginning and end? And what are the so each of these is a project with a beginning and end, and you're being asked to you know, add some and move them around or whatever. But I couldn't see what the project basically costs. It just staff says, well, some are done, so you might be able to add some more. Somewhere in the total $11 million of the planning and building department budget. So it's kind of like going to the auto mall and looking at some different cars but not knowing so much how much they cost. And these aren't flow work. These are projects with a beginning and end. And, you know, you can't tell precisely because you don't know what you're going to uncover in the process. But it seems to me that they should have a life budget over the years, and then you could measure how they're doing and kind of pick and choose, you know, with some eye toward the financial. That being said, we think that, of course, you've for the past some years had a very extensive and aggressive program of planning and regulation and so forth, and we would think that you need to step back and have a moratorium on projects, maybe suspend some of the ongoing projects, and ultimately reorient the planning and building department, not so much to the regulatory and so forth, but what could be done to try to help the economy, your budget, the folks who have foreclosures, employment, and everything else.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Merle Cliff, followed by Gwen Taylor.
Thank you, Chairman Patterson, and members of the board for the opportunity to be here today. My name is Merle Clift, and I'm here today on behalf of Moonstone Cellars, a small winery based in Cambria, and several other small winemakers throughout the county who couldn't all be here today simply because, in most cases, they're the only employee of their company. And they're used to trying to be in two and three places at the same time. They just don't have the time in the midst of harvest to be here for a whole day and present their case. So I'm trying to present it on their behalf. All of them are in favor of supporting the establishment of a category such as urban small wineries. Your current ordinance does not make any distinction between a winery, whether it makes one case of wine or 1 million cases of wine. The establishment of an urban small winery category with a limited case production, a limited agricultural production activities, and a strong retail component will enhance two of the major economic engines of San Luis Obispo County, tourism and wine. The establishment of this new category will additionally provide opportunities for new winemakers to establish new businesses, attracting desirable tourists to the communities of Cambria, San Miguel, Santa Margarita, Oceano, and others of the unincorporated areas. Templeton is another prime area. We understand that it takes time. We understand also that what might be true in the inland area might not be also true in time when you get to the coastal areas, and we understand that and are willing to work with planning staff come up with acceptable ways to mitigate potential problems that small wineries could present. But on behalf of all of those winemakers, we'd like to ask you to provide direct. It really is limiting bringing some tourists to these smaller communities where those tourist dollars could then also go to the restaurants, the art galleries, those kinds of things.
Okay, and again, what you're talking about is actually making the wine on site where you sell it.
Yes, but not, as was discussed earlier, and we're trying to eliminate that portion of the agricultural processing that could be offensive to the community, and that basically is crush. You don't want the truck traffic of crush. You don't want piles of stems and those kinds of things in a commercial zone. And that can easily be done because there's many custom crush facilities available to the small winemaker.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Gwen Taylor, followed by, Dr. Sehy.
Good afternoon. My name is Gwen Taylor. On the printout that was available to the community on page 11 of 25, Los Osos Habitat Conservation Plan Phase 1 and 2. It provides mitigation to allow development in Los Osos. The Prohibition Zone is paying for this conservation plan, and we as members of the community are worried about water. For the conservation plan to depend upon the adoption of development, because we have a conservation habitat plan without the verification of adequate water, is leaving a blank in there. To continue to promote conservation and habitat conservation in order for development is not the way to go. Conservation is water as well as what we have to do with the conservation plan in total. For you to sit and say that provide mitigation to allow development in Los Osos is disingenuous. And by that I mean you have no verification that there is adequate water. You have no verification that the sewer facilities are going to even address the major problem that we have in the community, which is saltwater intrusion. Conservation is for everything, whether it be water, whether it be land, or what it might be. We need a total conservation plan, not just a conservation plan that allows development. Paso Robles is the cash cow of the county because of the vineyards. Very well. Los Osos cannot afford to be a cash cow through the assessment district. We have a problem. It has not been addressed, and we need to have it addressed before any development plans are allowed. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Dr. C. Hyde, followed by Richard Margetson.
Dr. C. Hyde, Los Osos. And thank you for mentioning the Habitat Conservation Plan for Los Osos. And would you please state again when that plan is going to be completed? And I have a couple of questions about the Habitat Conservation Plans, because habitat is for creatures. So what I want to know is, I guess it would help if I knew when the plan was started. Did you take into consideration in this plan the ground seismic testing that went through Los Osos last year? And was there any kind of study is there like any kind of a study that is enumerating the number of birds or number of creatures? And was there any kind of study how, if anything, changed? And is your plan going to consider the kind of construction that's going on in Los Osos and what might be displaced? Because, you know, we keep hearing that when you ramp up sound, you know, sound vibrates through the ground. When you ramp, vibrates through the tidal waters. When you ramp up, there's marshes, sound, then creatures want to leave. And I've been documenting the birds that come to my seed bell. And I have a little sanctuary, tiny little sanctuary in Los Osos, and I've also been documenting the sound on my koi pond, and the fish really freak out when they have started that road drilling, and they won't feed, and the birds won't feed when the road drilling is going on, because it's the concussive sound. Can give us an answer when that plan's going to be done and what it's going to include. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hyde. Richard Margetson, followed by Eric Greeney.
Richard Margetson, on page 5 of 25 of the staff report, down towards the bottom, Water Conservation Retrofit Administration. Administration of the retrofit ordinance requirements for Los Osos and Napomo. Ongoing. On the last agenda item that you had, I gave you information that the staff report for that was incorrect. Spent 3 minutes proving the number was wrong. After public comment, you asked staff if there was anything they wanted to address. They didn't, and nobody followed up to ask if there was an issue there. There is an issue there. Mr. Gibson knows there's an issue there. Just like there was an issue when the retrofit ordinances came out. Not all of you were here, but some of you were here. Remember all the changes that were made to the ordinance? And Mr. Gibson keeps coming back with, no matter how many changes there were, the ordinance is still saving water. Well, if the ordinance is saving 1 to 2 acre feet, that's great last year. But at what cost? How long and how much staff time and how much consultant money was spent preparing these ordinances, the amount of time these ordinances were before this board through the hearing process. And I was in favor of both ordinances. I just wanted them done correctly. So obviously either you believe that 82 gallons is the savings from retrofitting a dwelling in Los Osos, which is more than 40% of the total indoor-outdoor consumption average in Los Osos. If you believe that, great. Then we'll just accept that and see how things play out down the road. My other comment deals with the Habitat Conservation Plan. I'm hoping that this progresses quickly, because in the last few months since the project looked like it was going to break ground, for sale signs have been going up all over Los Osos on the vacant lots. And I know for a fact that realtors are out there telling people that the wastewater project and the Habitat Conservation Plan, you're going to be ready to go. A complete misunderstanding of what the process is going to be down the road. And people are purchasing properties without understanding that there's a water issue, You don't even, and I don't see it anywhere on the list unless I missed it, you have to do a local coastal plan amendment with the Coastal Commission. You have to do the habitat conservation plan, build the wastewater project, secure a sustainable source of water, and do an LCP amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Margetson. Eric Greening.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and following up on the habitat conservation plan in Los Osos, assuming a draft does come before this calendar year, will this be a draft that will have been circulated for comments by the various agencies that have to weigh in on it and incorporates those comments, or will it be a draft that then begins that process of circulation? There's a considerable timeline difference between the two. Obviously, fish and our new state fish and wildlife, for example, successor to Fish and Game, and a lot of other agencies have to weigh in on it. I also want to ask about what kind of relationship, formal or otherwise, the planning department has with these clusters pursuant to the economic revitalization plan. I understand that the uniquely slow cluster is working with, and is this as a sort of a quasi-advisory committee? Because when these clusters were before you, although they had names attached to them, they were a concept. They were not people who had been appointed to anything that constitutes a committee. I know that much of the contact information on the people in those clusters at that time was way out of date, and many of the people listed as being parts of those clusters had no idea they were listed as parts of those clusters. So how are these clusters currently constituted? Are they named? If so, is there a public MADI book process for how they get named? I don't remember that they've been before your board to be named. Or are they just volunteers that say, I think I kind of fit with this uniquely slow group, and can I be part of it? I'm fine with that if it's simple. It exists. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Okay, let's see. Planning staff, I don't know if we have anyone from environmental here, but maybe Mr. Giffen or Ms. Griffin, someone can speak to the habitat conservation plan, the status of that, and there were a number of questions raised about it. One that I recall Mr. Greening just asked, if the draft, when that comes out, has that already been reviewed by the resource agencies, or are they part of the review process?
Certainly, Chairman Patterson's members of the board. I'll answer that, and there were also some other comments that came up during testimony, so I'll take the liberty to respond to some of those as well. First off, the Habitat Conservation Plan is funded by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and in coordination with the wildlife agencies, we will be looking at essentially extending take authority, which is take of endangered species, which is through a formal permit process, to address one land use issue, and that issue is biology. It's fair to say that when you're dealing with any development or growth issue, that there's more than one issue to deal with, whether it may be infrastructure or financing that infrastructure or the appropriate amount of density that is going to be proposed for a certain area, and biology is one of those. Completing the HCP by no means is going to be the only land use decision or project that has to move forward that's in association with the Los Osos community. But it is one that needs to be addressed there in the event that that area is going to develop with the infrastructure changes that are being made into the future. Essentially, what it involves is a agreement between the wildlife agencies and the county to essentially take on third-party beneficiary status, which essentially means the county is given certain delegated take authority then to give in a hypothetical situation that a developer would like to build a house or complete a subdivision or put in a commercial development that also contains habitat that supports endangered species, a permit to essentially have an impact to them, if you will, which is quote-unquote defined as take. Where we are right now is where you've been working through a process. We have a contract in place. We've been working with the wildlife agencies to identify the parameters of not only the scope, but to conduct our preliminary analysis of habitat and species in Los Osos. The first phase of that, the members of the public wanted to know, when is there going to be an opportunity for public engagement? Well, first off, since this is a grant from the Fish and Wildlife Service, we are first off meeting their requirements of the contract, so we are in close contact with them. At the conclusion of that, which Ms. Griffin said was going to be towards the end of the year, we should have a draft plan that is going to be reviewed by the wildlife agencies. At the conclusion of that, undoubtedly there will be some refinements, and then a document will be released for the public, and then that will be the opportunity to have the public engagement to look at a plan that's been at least vetted through the wildlife agencies to make sure that the design parameters of what the Habitat Conservation Plan is intending to achieve meets the intent of the grant funding that went along with it. In addition, on the topic of Los Osos, I will just venture off, and I know Mr. Margeson brought up twice on the previous item and on this item. I don't know off the top of my head whether or not the numbers that he brought up related to the 82 gallons a day per household are accurate just for toilets. I know there's also shower heads that are involved, although that amount may not be very much. But we'll go back and we'll recheck those numbers. And in fact, if there is an error, we'll look at it and we'll correct it. Some of the other items that were brought up by your board, as well as the public, is prioritizing some of the work that needs to be done and that we have been doing with our mandatory general plan elements. If you look at that list, our focus has been on incrementally going through the seven mandatory elements that every county and city needs to have in their general plan. Currently, we are working on the land use and circulation update, which, as Ms. Griffin pointed out, is being segmented into two phases. The next two ones that we would be looking at and that we added to the tables this time around are the noise element, which hasn't been updated in 20 years, and then the safety element, which we had a lot of discussion on already this morning. If the board would like to prioritize one of those ahead of the other, that now would be the time to do that. We put noise slightly ahead of safety, but that's not to say that they're not equally important, and it probably could be argued that safety is even more important. It's just the way we look at that as a balancing act of the age of the element as well as its current priority and need to be updated to be contemporary around one of the themes that they represent, whether it's green energy or specialized manufacturing. And we take that advice just like other advice and comments from other volunteer and organization groups. It is fair to say, though, that they have been involved in providing input with the county's economic element update. One distinct difference that Mr. Greening brought up was the economic strategy does not really focus on as a growth cluster on arts and culture. However, one of the changes that we did make, and you will see on the 23rd, is that we've added some provisions or a policy, short as it may be, that acknowledges the importance of arts and culture and its contribution to the economy. So you'll see that on the 23rd. I think that covers some of the higher level topics that were brought up by public review and or public comment. And if the board has any other questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Giffen. That covers the list that I have, but I wanted to follow up with the economic clusters. And actually, that was an effort that was spearheaded by the Economic Vitality Corporation. And the question I have is, when the various clusters meet to review a particular policy or provide input, is that done through the EVC, and is the public made aware of that or not? Do you know?
I'll go ahead and tackle that one. Just to recap for a little bit of history, it was by design that an organization outside of government headed up the economic strategy so as to pull in as many people as possible as opposed to it being a government-led effort. That being said, we are, an active agency, but the Economic Vitality Corporation, or EVC, is the lead on that. They have you know, it is volunteer driven. They have, you know, I'd have to check with Mike Manchek, see if the current list is up to date of folks or if there's been some turnover recently, but I'm sure that's something that could be addressed pretty quickly. With respect to what they review or don't review, they have been working closely with county planning staff following the agenda, and when there are items that are of interest, they let that out to the various cluster groups and ask if they want to weigh in, if it is something that the EBC wants to offer a policy perspective on. As Mr. Giff noted, the economic element, they were closely involved and reviewed that and a very active participant. The ag events ordinance, they've been closely involved with that, whereas some other issues, they've not been as interested. So it's really their call. The way we've set it up and viewed it is they are just one of many agencies or organizations or advisory groups or bodies that can weigh in on an issue. You know, planning can speak to this in more detail, but essentially they shotgun out the information to as many folks as they can, and anybody who would like to weigh in is certainly welcome to do so.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Buckshot. I appreciate that. Supervisor Gibson, did you want to offer some input?
I'd like to make suggestions, see if I can get colleagues' concurrence on this. I've got three topic areas. Might as well start with Los Osos. Appreciate staff's explanation of the specifics of a habitat conservation plan. It's not an overall conservation in the sense of conservation of water, and most specifically, it's not funded by the project, the wastewater project. It is not funded by the folks in the prohibition zone and covers rather a larger area than the prohibition zone. But I would like staff to comment briefly on how working with the HCP fits into conditions that would facilitate new development once the wastewater project is online. There are specific Coastal Commission conditions that are required to be met before undeveloped properties can hook up to the sewer, and one of them is indeed an update of the local coastal program for that area. It is, in fact, on the list as the Estero Area Plan update right at the top of page 12 of 25 in the tables, on page 12 of 25. But if staff could remind my colleagues and the board of the conditions precedent to undeveloped properties hooking up to the Los Osos Wastewater Project, I've got a suggestion for something I would like to see teed up for the top 10 list.
All right, Supervisor Gibson, I'll try. I'm going from memory, but right. There's two issues, one of which is we've been talking about today, which is the Habitat Conservation right. Plan, and then I think the second piece of that is sequencing and timing of the other items, including the LCP amendment. So first, I'll tackle the HCP, and then I'll see if Ms. Griffin can help me with the timing and sequencing of the other items.
There's actually the water basin management plan as well.
So first, from the Habitat Conservation Plan perspective, essentially what it would do, and this is essentially what all Habitat Conservation Plans do, is it consolidates and creates a way for people that would like to.
We initially took a shot at this. We actually did have an approved Los Osos Community Plan LCP amendment approved at the local level, and then when we took it up to coastal, we couldn't come to an agreement, and so it was extracted, and the rest of the Estero plan was approved. And so we're coming back to your board just to remind your board that the starting point is going to be that approved plan and kind of the timing and process from that point forward. I think what we'll do at that point, if your board authorizes, is that we'll ask that we combine those two efforts together, both the LCP and the HCP, into a single item on our top 10 list since they're so integrated. And then the water plan is an effort being done through the Public Works Department.
So there's really that idea that moving out of the HCP, which goes off for review, that we get going on the community plan update, which is the key of the LCP. Our timing, which I think is still possible, if somewhat ambitious, is to get that all together in time for the operation of the wastewater plant so we can move on with folks who have been trying. You know, as to the issues Mr. Margetson brings up, I appreciate staff's willingness to go and check out his numbers. I would remind colleagues, Mr. Margetson has brought forward a number of inconsequential errors in the water conservation ordinance that pertains to Los Osos. And I use that word very specifically in the sense that the addition errors and the particular numbers in particular tables that he has identified to us did not have any consequence in terms of water savings or not water savings. But, you know, he makes a certain, as he, you know, blurts out from the audience, as he often does, he makes certain assumptions in calculating his criticism of this particular number. Quick run with my calculator up here says that there's another set of assumptions that could quite reasonably explain that water savings. Again, I appreciate staff's willingness to go look into it.
Mr. Margetson, please, no outbursts from the audience.
So, anyway, that's the issues on Los Osos. As to the urban small winery, I think that is a straightforward ordinance amendment, a clarification, really, that would bring an economic opportunity, certainly consistent with our economic strategies. In the staff's staff report, it indicates, you know, whether we would, in this priority session, ask staff to add that to their active list. And I assume that not necessarily the top 10 list, but something that they would be working on, and I would seek colleagues' consensus on doing that.
Yeah, I definitely would support that.
And so with that general, then the last of the three topics I had was the question of the noise versus the safety element of the general plan. You'd indicated that the noise element was in the pipeline, not in the top 10 list. And the question of whether the safety plan might supersede it, what kind of time frame were you talking about with those two?
Well, we're looking at the noise element we put out on list four, which is technically year three. So it's the first set of things we look at when items come off our plate. We look to that list first. Safety element we have out in year five.
So to add to that, the way we – just to remind everybody, because I didn't say this in my opening comments, but essentially what we have is the equivalent of our legislative five-year plan, and we've got on our working plate what we have planned to accomplish over the next 18 to 24 months, and then going beyond that, we have years three, four, and five, where we essentially have different queues and three different pools as to where priorities sit. Now, those priorities on those lists are not funded. So if there's some reorganizing of items, namely noise and safety, and if you'd like to flip those around, we can do that. Or if it's something you think we should be thinking about moving to our active plate, then that's something I'd suggest we bring back to you with a plan in February.
Okay. And if I may follow up on that, Mr. Giffen, we heard from Mr. Alsop earlier about the hazard mitigation plan, and we do such extensive work because we have a nuclear plant here in San Luis Obispo County. Our standards are much higher than they might be otherwise, and I'm just curious, so I can make a better decision regarding safety versus noise, because I have noise issues come up. In fact, we all have relative to events and the difficulty in enforcing the noise standards, and so we might want to look at that. But I'm curious what the overlap is between the hazard mitigation plan and the safety element. What kinds of things have already been covered with the hazard
jurisdiction's general plan safety element? So there's many different ways to do it. Commissioner Topping's experience at Cal Poly I think is very useful, especially because he being at Cal Poly, this is a topic that he and some of his colleagues work on a lot. And this area is recognized for its expertise in hazard mitigation planning and safety planning. So we would definitely want to bring the two together. And so from my perspective, yes, noise is important, but what I'm hearing today, safety should probably go ahead of noise.
Okay. If that's what you're hearing,
Well, reading between the lines, I'm inferring that. If it's not, please tell
Well,
me
safety certainly is important. I feel like we do have a higher standard than most counties because of the nuclear power plant. We may already be adequately covered, and I know there's a lot of coordination inter-jurisdictionally, too, with the institutions and with the communities in developing that. But we can maybe follow up with that at the end of the conversation here. Supervisor Meacham wanted to comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'll go back to Supervisor Gibson's suggestions here. I think safety is, you know, I mean, if you don't have the safety, then noise isn't really going to matter. I think that safety would be a priority from my standpoint. The urban small winery, I think that that is a no-brainer thing. I think that's something we ought to move forward with and get that done as well. I have no issue with the Los Osos thing. But the one question that I do have, and this has to be related to Public Works, because I noticed in here you talk about coordination with Public Works on the IRWM and the Blue Ribbon Committee. I don't know when we're going to start engaging in conversation on the larger items that we can start working towards from a water standpoint. I know that we talked about just last week or week before last, and I think that there are much larger issues here, and I think that it's time that we engage in discussion and figure out how we can get to where we need to be from a water standpoint. I've got a lot of ideas about this, and I don't know how we engage Public Works in this to incorporate them as a priority. And then finally, I thank Mr. Buckshy for commenting on the EVC and the clusters, and I think that what they do basically is the same thing as maybe your home builders association. If they have an issue there that's directly related to their specific cluster group, then it affects them more than anybody else. We take their input, and I think it's a valuable input to have. So those are my comments.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Meacham. I wanted to follow up with one or two questions. First of all, I'll just say that I also concur with Supervisor Gibson and Supervisor Meacham regarding the urban small wineries. I think we need to do what we can do to get that process so it can become a reality. I wanted to ask planning staff, you've made, I think, four or five recommendations on items that we could possibly fill in the top 10 list. And one of those is the e-permitting for specific photovoltaic systems that Ms. Journey spoke to. And I'm wondering, again, because I think the solar access is important, would they in any way be related? I know one is a building issue and the other one's probably a planning issue, so I don't know if that's something that gives us some economy by putting them together. And I appreciate staff's feedback on that. And then also your recommendations for inserting the San Miguel Community Plan in the top 10 list. I'm certainly supportive of that. I think we need to do that. And also the Oceano Community Revitalization Plan. That's something that's underway, as I understand it. And I would think that would be something that we should continue the process. And then you've already told us that we have a mandate to get that post-construction stormwater piece done, but again, that's more of a, I believe, a building side of the department. No, that's a planning side?
Yeah, that would actually be changes to our stormwater ordinance that sits in the land use ordinance.
I see.
So it does have a building implication, but the actual ordinance amendments have to be done on the planning side.
Okay.
So the e-permitting and the solar access amendments wouldn't be related. The e-permitting choose or not choose to put into their local plans. So it really needs to run a little ahead of the San Miguel plan, because if there's anything in there as a recommendation that we might want to put into the plan, we'd need the joint land use plan done in advance. And that's kind of the track it's on right now.
Okay. So to give you direction, we should actually give you direction to complete that effort before completing the San Miguel Community Plan.
That would make the most sense, yes.
Okay. All right. We certainly want to make the most sense.
So okay. We endeavor.
If that's possible. Okay. So any other comments? Yes, Mr. Meacham.
Back to my question regarding the water issues in Public Works. Is there an opportunity to engage in discussion with them? As I know that has to do with planning as well. So
certainly, Supervisor Meacham, that we work with Public Works every day and we'll continue to do it, but perhaps I'd defer to the county administrator as far as how that would happen, whether it's as a part of a strategic planning session or whether it's offline. But we'll continue to work with the
And we do works. Have the County Master Water Plan that was just updated that sort of lays out priorities for them. Maybe we just need to review that again, perhaps.
Yeah, I would just add that maybe as a follow-up to this meeting, we could talk in more detail, and I could get with Jason and Public Works to work that through.
Okay, great. Any other comments? I see none. So, planning, do you feel comfortable with the feedback you've gotten this afternoon?
We do. Thank you very much for the feedback. The trend that we've tried to keep consistent with is the direction we've got at previous meetings is what we want to have on our top 10 list are things that are going to get done in the short and the midterm, and that's why the items we just walked through are items that, yes, they've already started, but they're getting to the point where we want to kind of raise their profile by having them on the top 10 list. A lot has been said this morning about public engagement. It does raise the awareness, and I'll pick the Oceana Revitalization as one, but we've talked this morning a little bit about transportation, but that's through a Caltrans grant to try to bring forward some improvements, hopefully through the revitalization plan to benefit that community, similar to San Miguel and some of the other items that are on the list. So we'll keep working towards that. The only wild card, we gave you a little bit of a preview related to legislation, which is the post-construction stormwater requirements. In February, we'll be coming back and giving you a more comprehensive update of what are the mandated changes, and there are several that will affect planning and our rules, whether it's related to energy or caps on permit fees. There are a number of items that we'll be bringing back and could cause a little bit of an obstacle for some of these priorities, but that'll be a discussion for the next strategic.
Okay, and related to that, Mr. Giffen, I know my colleagues are packing up here and are anxious to go. Can you give us a 3-minute? I know there's been a lot of changes over in planning. You've had some vacancies that you've recently filled. How are we looking staffing-wise to move these things forward?
Chairman Patterson, we're actually going to be bringing forward a consent item with a couple changes to the board on October 23rd. But essentially what we've done is we've continued to remain flexible and adaptable. We've consolidated our 6 former divisions into 3 divisions. We do have significant resource holes, both at the management's or soon to be at the management supervisor and staff level. And so far it hasn't affected service of our paying customers and meeting mandates, but that we're going to be continuing to look at resource allocation and what needs to be done to continue to deliver those services.
Slow and steady.
Yeah. I would just add that the planning department's done a nice job of outlining the issues and with some of the changes and retirements and and options for how to fill those and do so as cost effectively and as efficiently as possible, and some of those will be coming to your board. So they are continuing. That is a work in progress. I think we meet every few weeks to talk through the latest iteration as things continue to evolve.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Buckshy. Thank you, Ms. Griffin, Mr. Giffen. With that, we stand adjourned. Our next meeting will be 1 week from today, October 16th.